Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
Do you mind if we stay here a while, or must you go home?
There are no musts in my life. I'm free, white, and 21.
You're lucky.
Young people make up a large portion of the new COVID-19 cases that are being seen across the U.S. In some states, like Arizona and Florida, people under 45 account for more than half of all cases. As Stephanie Tsai reports, doctors are warning that young people need to take more precautions, not only to keep from spreading the virus to older Americans, but for their own sakes as well.
When Florida eased its lockdown and allowed restaurants and bars to reopen, 22-year-old Nikki Cortland was excited about the possibility of going out. She followed stay-at-home orders for more than 2 months.
The officials were coming on TV, you know, the governor, and stating that things were reopening and they were putting all of these safety measures into action.
I mean, people go, enjoy, have a drink, it's fine.
So I began thinking, okay, you know, I just graduated college. I missed my friends. Why not have one weekend in Orlando?
Armed with hand sanitizer and masks, Cortland and her friends went to dinner and then a bar.
It was pretty crowded, I would say. You definitely did not socially distance.
A few days later, Cortland got a fever. She tested positive for COVID-19. So did 30 other people she knew who went to the same bar.
I'm just trying to stay really calm, but it's really hard.
Cortland's case was relatively mild, but she said it was still a horrible experience.
I will never forget sitting there and watching the clock go from 3 a.m., 4 a.m., 5 a.m., 6 a.m., and not being able to get a deep breath and being alone.
Cortland has been using her YouTube channel to warn others that COVID-19 should not be taken lightly.
I just want them to understand that it can happen to you.
Many aren't getting the message. Several states have closed bars again, but young people are still going out. A survey from the Democracy Fund and UCLA found that during the first week of August, nearly half of Gen Zers and more than 40% of millennials socialized with people without maintaining social distancing. That's compared to 14% of baby boomers. And while statistically speaking, the younger you are, the less likely you are to be hospitalized for COVID, so many young adults are catching the virus that there are now more people age 18 to 49 who have been hospitalized than people age 50 to 64.
A lot of young people are getting sick.
Dr. Pratik Doshi works at Memorial Hermann Hospital in Houston.
I've seen multiple 20s, lots of 40s. And 50s that are out there right now that are getting sick and they're ending up in the ICU and not doing well.
Doshi says people can't assume they're low risk just because they're young.
There's a big difference between chronological age and physiological age. There's lots of 30-year-olds who are inactive, obese, that physiologically may be more like a 60-year-old.
As a whole, there's evidence that millennials aren't as healthy as past generations. A Blue Cross Blue Shield Association survey found last year that people born between 1981 and 1996 are more likely than Gen X to have health conditions such as high blood pressure, high cholesterol, and diabetes, all risk factors for COVID-19. But even young, healthy people have gotten severe and even deadly cases of COVID. Yvette Paz is a 30-year-old single mom, Army veteran, and hardcore workout buff who lives in Los Angeles. She didn't think much of it when she woke up one day in March with a searing headache and body aches.
I noticed a burning sensation in my eyes and a heaviness in my body, a very, very sore feeling, almost like I had a really, really big workout.
The symptoms got worse. She tested positive for COVID and was hospitalized that same day. She chronicled her experience on social media.
My doctor just left. He just notified me that I guess my white blood cells have been dropping really fast since yesterday, which is a little concerning.
One night, she says, she feared for her life.
I'm in the hospital bed. I feel like my lungs now are totally immobile. I'm trying to breathe. I'm frantically pushing this button to get the nurse.
She eventually caught her breath and was released from the hospital after a total of 5 days. 3 months on, she's feeling much better, but still has lingering side effects.
I do get winded a lot easier than before.
That's common among COVID patients. And doctors say they're still learning how COVID-19 can cause long-term lung damage.
We think that some of these patients may behave like a group of patients with lung fibrosis, pulmonary fibrosis, or interstitial lung disease.
What?
Last month, Dr. Ankit Bharat performed a double lung transplant on 28-year-old Myra Ramirez after she was hospitalized with COVID-19.
In these patients, we see a lot of bleeding into the lung, but also formation of blood clots. And they start to form a lot of scar tissue. There are a lot of cavities that form inside the lungs.
Ramirez has an autoimmune condition that might have made her more susceptible to the virus. She has since begun her recovery.
With the help of my family and support from the community and from my medical team, slowly but surely things have gotten a lot better.
New research shows COVID can cause lung damage even in asymptomatic patients. Then there's the mental health toll. In the UK, psychiatrists have recommended screening COVID-19 patients for post-traumatic stress disorder. Yvette Paz knows firsthand how traumatizing COVID-19 can be.
Mentally, it's horrible. I mean, I was having dreams where I died in the hospital.
Her experience brought back the PTSD she had from her time in the military. And in recent weeks, she's developed agoraphobia, a fear of going outside.
I went out to a store one day and I was in line and I freaked out. And I noticed that this was happening more and more. So there's only certain places that I can go to where I feel safe.
For Paz, the worst part of COVID-19 is the uncertainty. The uncertainty about whether it's damaged her lungs for good and about whether she could get the disease again. Doctors say over the last few months, they've learned how to better treat the virus, but there's still a lot they don't know.
We don't know what's going to be, whether you're going to get really sick or not. All we know is it's possible. That's the challenge. This is a brand new virus. This has never affected the human race before.
And it's why experts say all humans, even young ones, should stay on guard. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Stephanie Tsai.
Well, my name is Winifred Fredericks, also known as Sister Nandy. That's my name that I acquired during the civil rights struggle.
Winifred Fredericks was a daughter of New York City, a sister of the civil rights movement, and a mother to the next generation of black leaders. Fredericks died of COVID-19 in April, just 10 days before her 93rd birthday.
Mary Ellen Pfeiffer met Fredericks in the 60s at a Congress of Racial Equality meeting. They took part in freedom rides, sit-ins, protests, marching alongside the likes of Martin Luther King Jr.
Wendy was a very lovable, kind, dependable person. Whatever it was, you could count on her.
And for a time, many children counted on Fredericks for an education. Pfeiffer remembers the two of them organizing and teaching at freedom schools in the 60s.
These schools aimed to offer a better politically informed education to black children than they might get at public schools, which were often segregated.
We didn't just have them sitting, laughing and talking, playing some kind of little games. It was supposed to be a meaningful educational day.
In the 70s, Fredericks and her husband Maurice met a young Shagun Shabaka through a black power organization they were a part of.
They were what I call a power couple. They had a rich, rich, consistent, and long history of involvement in black people's struggle.
Dr. Shabaka says they lived their ideals. He remembers when fellow activists were jailed on what he calls trumped-up charges for murder.
The Fredericks and a few other families put their houses up as collateral for bail money. But when the activists were released, they fled the country, meaning the Fredericks were about to lose their home until their community came together.
Through all of that, anybody else might have been bitter, angry, turned away from the struggle. They became more involved in the struggle. And if you were to ever talk to her about it, she would light up and laugh about how people rallied around them and they were able to keep their home.
Now at home to her three children, Fredericks was mom.
Mom and I were very close.
That's Frederick's oldest daughter, Adele Lee.
She instilled a lot of values in me as a young girl and as a growing up woman, things that made me value myself.
In Frederick's final years, Lee and her mother would visit a local senior center where Frederick's enjoyed telling jokes to the residents.
You know, I had to censor them a little bit because she liked to read spicy jokes sometimes.
Lee remembers her mother's kind heart and playful nature. She says Frederick's had her convictions, too.
She was forceful in a quiet way, if you can understand what I mean. She never had any bad thing to say about anybody, but she had an opinion.
In an interview with students from Long Island University in 2013, Frederick's was asked what advice she had for young people.
To get involved in something, just get involved. I mean, don't just stand around. And once you start doing something, and sometimes you can see improvement. When you see improvement, you get more fired up, you know? There is a good feeling.
Winifred Frederick's sister Nandy, civil rights pioneer and mother, she was 92 years old.
High school football in Texas is probably behind God and guns. Well, I don't know. Right behind God, probably.
In the state of Texas, there is no bigger community involved activity than high school football.
Imagine Friday nights in Texas with no football this fall. Well, that has become the reality for Ben Bolt Polito Blanco High School in South Texas. The school board there recently voted to keep classes online for the first 9 weeks of the school year, which means no extracurricular activities during that time, which means no football. Ben Bolt is the first high school in Texas to cancel all fall sports. Gary Cunningham is the athletic director of Ben Bolt School District, and we want to welcome you to the show. Coach Cunningham, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
And what were the factors? How did y'all come to it?
I was torn from the beginning, torn between giving our kids some sense of normalcy, some sense of let's get back to the way things used to be, and my fear of keeping my kids safe, my coaches safe, and my coaches' families safe. As much as I hated the decision for our kids, especially for our seniors, that they're not going to get a chance to compete their senior year. At the same time, you know, what would happen if something did happen and one of our people got sick and God forbid, passed away from this stuff, you know, I don't think I could live with it. So in that sense, I don't think many people were shocked. Of course, some of the kids were upset, mainly our senior kids. But I think they, deep down inside, that they understand. Our community is taking it much better than I thought they would.
Oh, really? Because I am trying to imagine. I mean, this is Texas. It's Friday night without Friday night lights. How is that going down?
I guess I don't know if we're unique or I don't know. Some places are going crazy over the idea that they might not get to compete. As you would suspect, we had some parents that were upset, and mainly as the parents of seniors. But I don't think there's been the outpouring of anger that some people thought there was going to be.
Now, I said you're the first high school in Texas to cancel all fall sports. Are you talking to other athletic directors in the state? Are they saying, oh, man, I'm so sorry? Or are they saying, you know what, we might be right behind you?
Some are a little bit of both. Some are saying, you know, gosh, our hearts are broken for your kids and for your school. Some, I've had some phone calls from a couple of schools down in the Rio Grande Valley asking, you know, what went into the decision? Why did you make this decision? And how did the community accept this decision? Because I just don't think we're going to be the only school in the state of Texas that ends up not playing football. The Rio Grande Valley is just a hotbed of COVID cases and is spreading like wildfire down there. I just don't think it's going to be safe. I don't think they can make it safe. You know, I just don't think we're going to be the only school.
Yeah. Any plans to work with your players to help support them now that they'll be off the field for the fall?
It's really hard because, like I said, there's no kids on campus. All the thing we can do is kind of like this. You know, we visit with them on Zoom. We talk to them periodically on the phone. We check in with them to make sure, you know, they're doing okay. And we're still sending, we send out workouts periodically for them to do at home that they can get out and run and do a little lifting or just something so that we can stay in touch with them and know that we're still thinking about them and we're still in touch.
Yeah. That is Gary Cunningham, the athletic director of the Fighting Badgers. That's the Ben Bolt School District in South Texas, the first high school in Texas to call off fall sports. Gary Cunningham, thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Winners in 11 straight, champions of the Big Ten, Ohio State, and here come the Buckeyes.
Five months ago today, March 12, the NCAA called off spring sports because of the pandemic. Now a plan to play fall sports is in jeopardy. Two big college conferences, the Big Ten and Pac-12, say they will not play football or anything else because of the pandemic. What does that mean for a big football town? Nick Evans reports from WOSU in Columbus, home of the Ohio State University.
Columbus, Ohio lives for its football team, the Ohio State Buckeyes. The city is bigger than neighbors like Cleveland and Cincinnati, but doesn't have a pro team of its own. That means sports fans pour their attention into the college football team, regularly packing the 100,000-seat stadium on brisk Saturdays in the fall. But COVID-19 is changing all of that. At Planks Beer Garden, talking heads on big screens are chewing over the decision to delay games. So is Greg Wright.
It's tough. When you're a Buckeye fan, you're a Buckeye fan, and not getting to see him play is very disheartening. In my personal opinion, I think it's a crock.
Wright is skeptical about how dangerous the virus is to players' health. Instead, he worries what the move means for those headed to the NFL. He wonders how the changes might impact recruiting, as rising high school players try to catch on with college teams. And he's annoyed that only about a week ago, the Big Ten released its schedule for the coming season.
They kind of build you up and then pull the rug out from under you. And I think that's really disappointing. You know, we were expecting, you know, interleague games, and then now it's gone.
But in an interview on the Big Ten Network, Commissioner Kevin Warren insisted that schedule was always contingent on what they knew about the virus.
We felt it was important to plan to organize a schedule that if we were fortunate to play fall sports, and especially football, that we would have to, we would have a schedule in place. But, you know, 6 days is 6 days. And I made it very clear also that this was a day-to-day situation.
Still, Warren wouldn't point to any specific medical concern that changed the calculus, citing instead the, quote, uncertainty of the moment. Simone Sanders isn't buying it. She agrees with putting off the season, but says they should have made the call sooner.
They should have thought about what they were going to do when they knew coronavirus was coming. You know what I mean? Like way, way back in like April or whatever the time is. But you wait until almost September when you know football season is coming.
But for a city that puts so much stock in its college football team, the prevailing emotion isn't anger so much as resignation. Monty Elmore sits in his car at the grocery store. Kids are playing in the back seat. And he acknowledges this delay might not be the last.
Yeah, because they say we haven't seen the worst of this virus, so. Yeah. And it's almost flu season, so yeah, I mean, I expect to see it be pushed back some more, maybe even put off for the whole year. So I would like to see them play, but not at the cost of their life.
In a statement announcing the move, Ohio State Athletic Director Gene Smith wrote, caring for athletes' health and safety is their foremost responsibility. The school says players will continue to train, and those who have scholarships will keep them. For NPR News, I'm Nick Evans in Columbus.
You're gonna go and terrorize some black females, some black ladies standing on a bus stop, come up here and show your Uzi and have them all frightened? I notice you pick those of you who do this. You pick your targets. You know who to pick on. And you say that you're bad, but you're not really bad. Because if you're bad, you take on the good old boys. I mean, the boys with the caterpillar hats and the long hair and riding a motorcycle.
Thousands of bikers and motorcycle enthusiasts are descending on South Dakota's Black Hills for the 80th annual Sturgis Motorcycle Rally. For many, it's a welcome break from pandemic restrictions, but as you can guess, it's also raising public health concerns, as South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Lee Strubinger reports.
Hundreds of rallygoers pop in and out of storefronts and bars and tattoo parlors on Main Street in the downtown. It's packed, really packed. Bikes cruise up and down the strip, and very few people are wearing masks. As I walk through the crowd in a mask, it's clearly taken as a political statement.
COVID? You must caught the fear.
Walking down a block from the main show, and see who I can talk to.
I duck into the Sturgis tattoo shop just off of Main Street, where Lenny Borg has come to give tattoos during the rally. He's wearing a mask to keep clientele safe and comfortable, but he's not asking them to wear one.
I'll protect myself, and I think they have the right to choose what they want to do. And likewise, they should let me choose what I want to do.
Borg says rallygoers like him are drawn to Sturgis because of the long history of the event. He says they love motorcycles and America.
No matter all the that's going on in it right now, you know, I think one of the allures is you can kind of not be ruled by the government and not be, you know, feel a little bit more free out here.
South Dakota has been hands-off in its approach to the pandemic. It never shut things down. The state is one of the only in the country without mask requirements or restrictions on public gatherings and no standing 6 feet apart. Officials expect about 250,000 people to attend over the course of 9 days, which is about half of a typical rally. The State Department of Health is not offering any coronavirus testing during the rally. The city will have 1,300 tests for residents who want one once it's over. This isn't the first major event in South Dakota since the pandemic swept across the country. In July, 7,500 people, including President Trump, attended a fireworks show at Mount Rushmore. Republican Governor Kristi Noem told Fox News, it's a point of pride.
So we know we can have these events, give people information, let them protect their health, but still enjoy their way of life and enjoy events like the Sturgis Motorcycle Rally. We hope people come. Our economy benefits when people come and visit us.
To me, it's not worth taking the chances.
That's Mary Graham, a retired nurse practitioner who has lived in and around Sturgis for over 40 years.
I just think it's really dangerous. If you open it up and have the rally, it kind of makes it seem like, oh yeah, it's okay, go ahead and come.
Graham is among 60% of Sturgis residents who said they wanted the rally postponed this year. John Schaff is a political science professor at Northern State University.
Part of what the whole ethos of the rally is that American freedom of the open road, that you get on your motorcycle and you ride, right, and you feel free.
But Schaff says that conflicts with the need to respond to a public health emergency.
Throughout U.S. history, there's been this resistance from some quarters to being told what to do.
For the next week, the rally and the coronavirus may seem like a local problem for Sturgis and the state of South Dakota. But the people here for the rally come from all corners of the country and will soon be going back home. For NPR News, I'm Lee Strubinger in Sturgis, South Dakota.
My life is played out like a jerry curl. I'm ready to die. Declaration. Declaration.
Declaration. Die, motherfucker. Die, motherfucker. As I sit back and look when I...
Last week, we mourned the loss of Malik Abdul Basset, better known as Malik B, a hip-hop artist and one of the founding members of the legendary group The Roots. Malik was only 47.
Now go get your dictionary and your pictionary. Cause much affliction with my diction, friction, just and carry. Words and hers like some cattle in the steeple. People, there's no equal or no sequel.
The exact cause of Malik's death has yet to be confirmed, but it fits into a troubling pattern of rappers, especially those from the golden era of hip-hop's early days, dying young from illness. Eazy-E from N.W.A. died from complications with AIDS at 30 years old.
I'm so ill with it, so deal with it. I'll be potted out.
J. Dilla died from a heart attack at 32.
Yo, yo, whoa, get at me. You wanna clap me? Bitches wanna rap me? Put it right where they back be. Keep my thumbs low.
Prodigy, who was half of the group Mobb Deep, died from choking and complications with sickle cell anemia at 45.
Hey, yo, my man Fife Diggy, he got something to say.
I told you in the jam that we can get down. Now let's knock the roots like the group H-Town. You got DVD.
Fife Dog from A Tribe Called Quest died from complications with diabetes at 45. And the list goes on.
This is how I represent over this here beat.
Dart Adams is a hip-hop journalist and historian, and he joins me now to help us understand why so many hip-hop artists are dying young. Dart, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Just listening to those tracks back to back to back, you just realize that the genius, frankly, that we've lost in the hip-hop community and so young. Dart, what's going on here? Is there something about the industry that's intensifying and creating health problems for these folks? Because these are my contemporaries.
The fact of the matter is that when you work in the music industry, especially when you're signed to a record label, it's basically a new update of the sharecropping ideal. So you get a loan, essentially, and you have to pay it back. And you don't make any money until you recoup that loan. And if you record your album, there's certain costs and overhead. And until you make all that money back for the label, you don't really make money, except for maybe the money you make for shows, which is dependent on how successful your music is. So what I'm saying is, if you're a creative or you're on a label and you're a musician, that you might have to hustle and work three times harder than you initially, you know, hoped, just to be able to see any money, even though you're all over the place and you're visible. So there's that stress added to it. And there's no health insurance that comes with this, you know. So I could run off a list of a whole bunch of MCs that weren't named in your segment that died due to some health issues.
I mean, a lot of these people that we're talking about are Black and or Latino. What role does that race and economic background play into what we're talking about?
Well, okay, I live in the South End, Lower Roxbury, and if you go further down into Roxbury or the Back Bay, there's a big difference between the life expectancy of people who live in that area or Beacon Hill versus Roxbury. It drops like more than 10 years. And if you extrapolate that and deal with, all right, we have a bunch of people from the inner city and they're Black and Latino and they already might have health complications and there's no health insurance in the music industry. If you have any extenuating circumstances with your health going in, it's going to be exacerbated by constantly having to work, go on tour. You can't take care of yourself and you can't take days off, especially now that there's even less money in the industry.
Dar, you've been covering the hip hop industry for decades now. What's it been like to watch rappers start, you know, who were passing away in their 30s and 40s? You said, you know, other MCs who weren't on that list of luminaries at the top.
Yes. I mean, when I think about guys like Poetic, aka Grim Reaper, he died of colon cancer, and they had to raise money just to get him treatment. I mean, I have so many numbers in my phone. 2 days ago was the anniversary of the passing of my friend Peyton Locke, who was an independent hip hop producer and rapper, and he died also of cancer. Sean Price died in his sleep. So when you have any type of health issue, we're not getting the help that we need. We don't have coverage and we have to work that much harder just to be able to see any kind of financial benefit or profit. So in this day and age of this exponential age, you know, you have to get above the noise. Imagine how much work you have to be, because you have to do everything now.
Dart, we're talking about illnesses that are manifesting physically for a lot of people, but we're not talking about mental health. And mental health, there's been a lot of talk about that with recent coverage of Kanye West and how the industry perceives or doesn't perceive mental health issues. How has the hip-hop community done when it comes to mental health?
I think there were, in the 90s, we had very few people that understood that what some of the people were rapping about was actually struggling with mental health. Scarface was early doing it. You had other MCs that were just talking about different things like Notorious B.I.G.'s Ready to Die. That album is talking about his fading mental health while he's trying to hustle and make money and stay above water. These are the same kind of situations that artists now face, especially in a system where you're not making that much money from streaming revenue and you can't tour anymore. So if you had any type of pre-existing health condition, it's going to be exacerbated now because what, you're going to go to the hospital where they might be overrun with COVID cases? You don't want to go to the hospital unless you have anything short of something super serious. And by that time, it's already too late. And we've been dealing with that for the last 4 months.
And right now we're talking really about male rappers so far. But what about women rappers in the industry who often don't get the same attention as male rappers? Do we know whether they too are experiencing the types of illnesses that we're talking about here and other types of health pressure?
Unfortunately, with women, they might be dealing with the same issues, but it's also made worse by the fact they're being preyed upon and they're victims of violence and all these other issues that women have to deal with on top of the things that are going to affect them and their health because they're Black and Latino. I mean, if you look at the birth rate or like the rate of women that die while giving birth or the death rates of children that are Black and Latino, it's insane. When I was told by a couple of people that worked in the hospital.
So, Dart, what are people, I mean, at some point, this is not a new issue. We just went through a whole list of people. You gave me your list of people. I mean, at some point, if the industry isn't doing anything for its artists, what are the artists doing for each other? I mean, are artists beginning to talk about things like that we're talking about right now, just in terms of, you know, the health issues that disproportionately affect Black and Latino communities in particular? I mean, are artists doing anything to protect each other or themselves?
Absolutely. I think that there was a big groundswell of things happening after. So August 8th will be the fifth anniversary of the passing of Sean Price. And when Sean Price passed away, I think that was a big turning point and people waking up. And it happened right after we lost another guy from Brooklyn, Pumpkinhead, PH as most people know him. So these guys were really big in the underground rap community, especially in Brooklyn. And they were tied to everybody from the rap recording world to the freestyle battle world. And when they passed away, you know, people started wanting to be healthier, changing their lifestyle around. A lot of people went either vegan, vegetarian. So there was a whole lot of talk about being more active and being around and trying to survive into your 40s when we started seeing our peers pass away. You know, that there's that line of 40 to 45. And when we start seeing our peers pass away, it starts to really affect you. Especially I have about 25 numbers in my phone. And they've all passed away within the last, like, 3 to 5 years. And I'll never call them. I'll never be able to text them again. And it's insane to think that I turned 45 in 3 weeks.
Dart Adams is a hip-hop journalist and historian. Dart, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Remember, no one is going to treat you special just because you are Black.
The Justice Department is accusing Yale University of discriminating against Asian American and white applicants based on their race. The DOJ has spent years investigating the way Yale handles undergraduate admissions. I should note that I graduated from Yale. In a statement, the school denies the allegations and says it won't change its admissions practices. Melissa Korn writes about higher education for the Wall Street Journal and joins us now. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
What led to this Justice Department investigation of the Yale admissions process?
The investigation, which started in 2018, was actually based off of a complaint that was filed by a group of Asian Americans alleging that Yale was discriminating against Asian Americans in admissions, in holding them to a higher standard and not admitting them at the rate that they should be admitted based on their academic credentials.
And what was the response from Yale? I mean, they deny these allegations from the Justice Department. What's their version of the story?
Right. So Yale says that they have a holistic admissions review process, that they look at academics as well as extracurriculars, leadership, an applicant's background, and race. And race is part of that, but certainly not the determinative factor. It's one of many elements that goes into the decision-making process. So Yale has said that they're not going to change their policies, their practices right now, even though the Department of Justice said in its letter today that Yale needed to make some changes and not consider race, or if it's going to consider race, set an end date for when it would stop considering race. And if it didn't within 2 weeks, then the Justice Department could file a lawsuit. So it seems that we're heading toward litigation.
And is this bigger than Yale University? Is this about race-based admissions and affirmative action nationally?
Absolutely. This is kind of part of a growing and escalating attention that the Trump administration is paying to race in college admissions. They've supported a lawsuit against Harvard. They had an investigation at Harvard as well. They are definitely paying attention to the role of race in admissions and potentially angling for something to head back to the Supreme Court on this matter.
And so if the Justice Department does file a lawsuit based on Yale's refusal to change its admissions policies, does everything then hinge on the November elections, or where does this go?
Quite possibly. We could see if the administration changes, Department of Justice could, a new Department of Justice under new leadership could change tack and drop a lawsuit, or it could continue. November could definitely affect how long this saga will go on.
That's Melissa Korn, reporter at The Wall Street Journal. Thank you for speaking with us today.
Thanks so much.
There's a conspiracy theory sweeping the globe that coronavirus is caused by 5G technology.
The theory is that 5G damages the human immune system.
All of us should know what's taking place right under our noses.
What 5G actually does, it absorbs oxygen, and that's really important to know.
5G gets switched on, people drop like flies, and all of a sudden you've got the excuse because, well, there's a virus going on.
Some people in the UK bought into it so much they started lighting cell phone towers on fire.
5G burning, 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 burning.
QAnon, or Q, is a conspiracy theory. Believers think President Trump is leading a secret rebellion against a dangerous cabal of deep state elites. Now, that theory is moving from the fringe to Capitol Hill. After a runoff election yesterday, Georgia is poised to become the first state to send someone who has supported QAnon to Congress. NPR's Hannah Alam has more.
Georgia Republican Marjorie Taylor Greene is a pariah inside her own party over her past racist and bigoted statements. But this week, it's another kind of extremism drawing attention to her run for Congress.
All right, so Q is a patriot. We know that for sure, but we do not know who Q is.
That was Greene in a video a couple years ago, one of several social media posts where she mentions Q, or QAnon. It's a conspiracy theory that emerged on right-wing message boards in 2017. It spread quickly through Facebook groups and homemade documentaries like this one on YouTube.
What do we have for now? Donald Trump as president of the U.S. And then, out of nowhere, arose the enigma of Q.
Those who buy into the baseless theory think President Trump is leading a secret war against Satan-worshipping pedophiles in the deep state. They believe someone known only as Q is helping by leaving encrypted messages for self-proclaimed digital soldiers to decode.
Q is a peaceful movement. Our only weapon is truth.
That's a Q supporter in an episode of the podcast QAnon Anonymous. The show takes a deep, skeptical look into the world of QAnon.
What's up, QAA listeners?
One of the hosts, Travis View, says QAnon is so outlandish, so ridiculous, that most people didn't take it seriously. Not federal authorities, not social media platforms. At least, not until Q believers started running for office.
When things go sort of viral online, even if they're, you know, dangerous extremist movements, they might be dismissed as fringe. But once they start entering the halls of Congress, then that makes people sit up and pay attention.
The watchdog group Media Matters for America counts 19 congressional candidates with links to QAnon who will be on the ballot in November. Many are long shots, not Marjorie Taylor Greene. Her primary win in a deep red district means she's all but assured a seat in Congress. Trump has already tweeted his congratulations. These days, Green is no longer making videos about Q, but she hasn't disavowed the conspiracy either.
Yes or no, are you a follower of QAnon?
That's local news Channel 9 trying to pin Green down last month. Her response?
I'm just like millions of people here in our country and then millions of people around the world that are very much concerned about a deep state and our government. And
Green never gave a clear yes or no. NPR reached out to her. She declined to speak with us.
I think Marjorie Taylor Greene started in the bucket where she truly believed in QAnon, but now she's probably drifting more towards the political constituency.
Mark Andre Argentino recently wrote about QAnon for the Combating Terrorism Center at West Point. He worries Q is fueling extremism. Last year, an FBI memo called it a potential domestic terrorism threat. Several Q supporters already have been linked to serious crimes. Aoife Gallagher tracks QAnon for the London-based Institute for Strategic Dialogue.
That's almost like a cult. You know, it really becomes this almost cult-like thinking. They have their mantras and their oaths, and they, you know, are so dogmatic in their thinking.
Gallagher says the conspiracy now goes well beyond American politics. International Q groups have formed. It's sweeping up New Age and anti-vaccination types. It's reaching millions across social media platforms, outpacing new efforts by tech companies to contain it. Hannah Lam, NPR News.
Hear these words. You will never be ignored again. Your voice, your hopes, and your dreams will define our American destiny. And your courage and goodness and love will forever guide us along the way. Together, we will make America strong again. We will make America wealthy again. We will make America proud again. We will make America safe again. And yes, together, we will make America great again. Thank you, God bless you, and God bless America.
Senator Kamala Harris makes history in several ways, including this. She is the first American of Asian descent on a major party presidential ticket, and for many members of the large and growing Indian American community, her selection is a thrilling moment. One of those celebrating is our next guest, Sri Preston Kulkarni. He's also running as a Democrat for office this November. He is hoping to be the next congressman from the 22nd District of Texas. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Ari.
Well, after the announcement yesterday, you tweeted, "I can't emphasize enough just how important and exciting it is to finally see ourselves represented on the national stage in this way." What went through your mind when you heard the news, and what have you been hearing in the last day from other Indian Americans?
It's hard to overemphasize how important this day was yesterday. For somebody like me, a kid growing up here in Texas, as an Asian American who's running to be the first Asian American ever elected to U.S. Congress, this is going to inspire all of us. Asian American families across my district and across this state are going to be energized like never before. Our community is the largest, the fastest growing community in Texas, and Texas 22 has the largest Asian American population. Kamala Harris being nominated to vice president is going to excite and energize people. You're going to have record turnout from our community. It's going to help flip Texas 22 blue, and it's going to help flip Texas blue as well.
She is also of Jamaican descent. It sounds like you're saying that in no way dilutes the Asian American community's enthusiasm for her. Is that right?
Absolutely not. I mean, we are all energized. This district is one of the most diverse districts in the entire country. We have a huge African American population, a huge Asian American population, huge Anglo American population, huge Latino American population, but none of those are a monolith. So, for example, in the Asian American community, in our campaign, we were reaching out in 21 different languages. So we reach out in Chinese and Vietnamese, Gujarati, Telugu, Kannada, Hindi, Urdu. And the result of that was that we got 30,000 new people to show up in 2018 who hadn't voted for president. And then we registered 50,000 new voters on top of that. And our incumbent dropped out of the race because the truth is diversity is who we are here in Texas. But inclusion is what we do. And so this is about bringing all communities together. There's one message out there of division in this country. And there's another message, another vision of inclusion. That's what we're trying to do, is run the most inclusive campaign ever.
President Trump has touted his close personal relationship with Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi. Last year, about 50,000 members of the Indian diaspora came out to see Trump and Modi at a rally in Houston, your backyard. Is there a risk that Democrats are putting too much weight on demographic identity? Many Indian Americans are social conservatives who might lean Republican.
So what you've seen happen in our district is that most of the Asian Americans were not being communicated to by Republicans or Democrats. 72% of them had never heard from either party. And when you talk to them, when you actually work through their communities, we like to say our campaign is powered by aunties who call other people within the community and they bring them out. They have the same concerns. They care about health care. They care about reasonable leaders who care about protecting our families from coronavirus, about education, about a clean environment, safe schools for our kids. That's why people are coming out. They don't like this instability that we're dealing with right now. They want to get back to normalcy.
Democrat Sri Preston Kulkarni is running for Congress in the 22nd District of Texas. Good to talk with you today. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much, Ari.
We will make America great again.
All right, this news about Kamala Harris being tapped as Joe Biden's running mate comes as President Trump has been trying to make the case that his presidency is a boon for Black Americans. That was always going to be a difficult case to make. Then the coronavirus put his campaign's outreach on hold. Now in critical cities, including Milwaukee, field offices are back up and running. NPR's Aisha Roscoe reports on whether the message is connecting.
I've done more for African Americans than any president, with the possible exception of Abraham Lincoln. And that's true. I passed criminal
justice. I did more for the Black community than anybody, with the possible exception of Abraham Lincoln.
With the possible exception of Abraham Lincoln. Nobody has even been close.
Despite President Trump's bragging, Black voters still overwhelmingly back his Democratic rival, former Vice President Joe Biden. And that's not surprising for a Republican president. Still, according to a CNN analysis, Trump is doing slightly better with African-American voters than he did in polls ahead of the 2016 election. After a hiatus due to the coronavirus, the Trump campaign is back on the ground in Milwaukee and other key cities with large African-American communities. In a tight election, squeezing out a few more votes for Trump could make a difference. Paris Denard is a senior advisor on Black media for the Republican National Committee.
Because of the restrictions and the things that we have to abide by, we've had to sort of change our engagement.
Back in late February, just before the pandemic shut down the country, the campaign held a panel discussion in their storefront field office in North Milwaukee with speakers flown in from around the country. About 50 people attended. Denard says where local health regulations allow, the party is once again holding in-person events. In recent weeks, the Milwaukee office has hosted a cookout and a movie night screening a documentary about Black conservatives. The campaign wants to combat what they view as unfair media coverage, says senior campaign advisor Katrina Pearson.
We knew we could not depend on the mainstream press to tell Americans exactly what this president is doing and has done for them.
But one of the campaign's key talking points, low Black unemployment, no longer exists thanks to the coronavirus. And polls show that most Americans of all races believe that Trump increased racial tensions after protests about the killing of George Floyd. Orlando Owens is a Black Republican running for the Wisconsin State Legislature, representing part of Milwaukee. The seat's been held by Democrats for decades. Owens says he's been knocking on doors, making the case for his own campaign, but President Trump does come up, and not necessarily in a good way.
I see some who like President Trump. I see a lot more that question his moves.
He says he never bashes Trump, and he focuses on what he could do for his district. Some people do ask him, do they have to vote for Trump if they vote for him?
I said, listen, you do whatever you think you need to do on the presidential level. But you don't have to vote straight party. You can vote for each individual race. And people smile.
Back in February, Quinn Taylor was one of the Milwaukee residents who attended the Trump campaign panel discussion. Taylor, who is African American, says he's still open to voting for Trump, but he wants him to be more serious and presidential.
The typical Trump, he speaks too fast, not prepared for a question, and just talk. So, you know, you don't always get the president answer, you get the Trump answer.
Taylor says he also wants to see the field office do more to help the community. RNC advisor Denard acknowledged that the campaign has more work to do to make sure its connections have lasting impact. Even though Taylor attended a campaign event, he says they haven't contacted him other than generic emails. And that movie night the office held, Taylor says he would have attended, but he never heard about it. Aisha Roscoe, NPR News.
Hate crime allegations now follow this viral video out of Barrington. The man was caught on camera calling his neighbor a racial slur during an alleged assault, and now he faces tougher punishment if found guilty. But he claims he was hit with a hammer. NBC10's Brian Crandall live in Barrington tonight with the new developments and a protest outside the suspect's house. Brian?
Well, Patrice, the attorney general is now seeking hate crime punishment against the man in the video. The lawyer for that man says he regrets his words, but that the confrontation was not a hate crime.
You're rude.
Did you see this?
You are rude.
Asshole.
You.
In the video, a man can be heard calling his neighbor the N-word, preceded by the F-word, as he allegedly attacks the neighbor in Barrington last Monday in a dispute over a boundary marker.
You called me a.
I did.
71-year-old Richard Gordon was charged by police Friday with simple assault and disorderly conduct. Now, Rhode Island Attorney General Peter Nerona's office has filed for an enhanced hate crime sentencing. That means if Gordon is convicted of the other charges, and if it's proven he was motivated by the victim's race, religion, national origin, or other category in the hate crime laws, he would be sent to prison for at least 30 days, and potentially up to a year. No answer at Gordon's house this afternoon, but his lawyer sent me a statement claiming Gordon was hit with a hammer by the alleged victim before the camera was turned on. His hand is bloody in the video. The lawyer says while Gordon's, quote, racially charged language was certainly inappropriate and unacceptable, he argues this was a mutual confrontation that did not amount to a hate crime. Black Lives Matter thinks otherwise.
I think that it's obvious that's what it was to me. I mean, there's no ambiguity if the guy's committing an assault and he's using racial profanity.
And Black Lives Matter had a small protest outside Gordon's house this afternoon.
The whole thing was just despicable to me completely. You cannot just act on your bigotry with impunity.
Black Lives Matter leaders say they would be willing to speak with Gordon, but have not reached out to him.
If he doesn't know already, then there would be no point in me trying to present any argument to him.
And Gordon's lawyer says he regrets his, quote, poor choice of language and the distress it's caused the alleged victim and his family, and will offer an apology at an appropriate time. We also did try to reach out to the alleged victim. I'm Brian Crandall, NBC 10 News, live in Barrington.
This is St. Louis Public Radio. Since a Minneapolis police officer killed George Floyd in May, black therapists have been in demand. Many black people have sought counselors to try to help them cope with the stress of police brutality and systemic racism, the coronavirus pandemic, and job losses. St. Louis Public Radio's Andrea Henderson asked St. Louis psychologist Romaiko Thomas why having a black therapist is so important for many clients.
One of the reasons that I feel that it's important, or I've noticed it's important, is that looking for camaraderie and understanding, you know, going to therapy is very, it's a very humbling and a very, it's not an automatic experience, meaning that it's almost, can some people can feel intrusive. And can feel very put on the spot. And so one of the reasons that we're seeing that people feel more comfortable in talking to providers that look like themselves is that there's this feeling of, okay, this person may not be the same person I am, but can at least understand or have some sensitivity to the response and what I'm going through.
Why is prioritizing mental health so necessary for Black people?
It's necessary because we deal with a lot on a daily systemic basis. So, you know, overt racism, covert racism, microaggressions. And then also we're having to pack it all in order to go to work or in order to find jobs. And so I think that as Black people, to really address our mental health and address that, hey, we cannot do it all, is humongous. It's also to really think about what is it like to normalize our mental health. And just within that itself, it'd be great if we start to look at self-care in a different way. And so I think that it's very beneficial, but also crucial for us to start looking at our mental health, because it is impeding our progress and who we could ultimately be.
What are some ways that the Black community can start demystifying the negative stigma that surrounds mental health?
I think one of the things that I've noticed is some of the pastors in the churches have started talking about mental health and have incorporated it into some of the sermons and talking about the importance of mental health and looking at mental health in a holistic form. So a lot of times we talk about physical health, we talk about whether it's blood pressure, diabetes, cancer, all of these things, but we don't really pay homage to mental health and what that can do within our, what mental health can do and how complex mental health is. And so it can also start with physical health and going to the physical physician, and they can be more trained in talking to patients about mental health and that their physical difficulties that they may be experiencing may be contributing or have a correlation to their mental health status too. And so more education, I feel, needs to be done when it comes to internists or physical doctors or specialists to start talking about mental health to their patients. And that can form a bridge between the two as well.
This the city of Chicago.
It matters what you call street violence during a protest. Is it a riot? Is it rebellion? Is it an uprising or just plain looting? Protesters in Chicago after a police shooting were unusually upfront in labeling some of their own actions Sunday night looting. And in response, last night, Chicago authorities raised the bridges into downtown and stopped many trains. WBEZ's Chip Mitchell has been covering the story. Chip, good morning.
Morning.
How did all this start, Chip?
After midnight, late Sunday, heading into Monday, as many as a few thousand people started arriving along the main shopping corridor downtown. Upscale stores, they were smashing in windows and taking things by the armful or even filling up cars.
And they also surrounded a police station and were pretty frank about what their goal was here, what they believed in as a tactic.
Yeah. So then the next evening, last night, 150 protesters led by Black Lives Matter Chicago, they came to support the alleged looters. About 100 of them had been arrested the night before, and they were getting released slowly from police custody. The protesters had this big banner. It was hand painted and it said, "Our futures have been looted from us. Loot back." So here's Arielle Atkins. She organized the protest and took questions from reporters about the looting.
"My people are struggling. People in this city are struggling through a pandemic. So I don't care if somebody decides to loot a Gucci or a Macy's or a Nike, because that makes sure that that person eats. That makes sure that that person has clothes. That makes sure that that person can make some kind of money, because this city obviously doesn't care about them. Not only that, that's reparations."
So she's talking about reparations for the injustices Black people have faced since slavery, Steve.
Let's back up a little bit here. What led to the looting and then the second night of protests that police tamped down somewhat?
Yeah, the city's new police superintendent, his name's David Brown. He said the looting stemmed from a shooting by Chicago officers Sunday afternoon on the South Side. It was in the poorest neighborhood of the city, one of the poorest neighborhoods. They shot and injured a 20-year-old man. Brown says that man had fired at the cops first. So as the police were processing the scene, they got into a confrontation with a crowd of people. Brown said that crowd kept growing, that misinformation about the shooting spread. And he said social media posts then led to what he called a caravan of cars that went downtown to loot. Mayor Lightfoot said there's a big difference between protesting against police brutality and that looting.
This had nothing to do with legitimate, protected First Amendment expression. These were not poor people engaged in petty theft to feed themselves and their families. This was straight up felony criminal conduct.
What do residents have to say about all this, Chip?
Well, they're struggling to make sense of it. So yesterday in this one neighborhood just north of downtown, a bunch of swanky department stores had been looted. Several residents told me they get why people are protesting police brutality, but none agreed with an analysis we often hear on the city's south and west sides that the economy is so rigged that looting like this is to be expected. Now, some residents of this neighborhood also said they'd like to see the National Guard deployed against looters. It's something some Republican lawmakers called for, too, but Mayor Lightfoot said the National Guard is not needed.
Chip Mitchell of WBEZ. Chip, thanks.
My pleasure.
Billie Holiday, I sing your blues. Bet your life against me and I swear to God you'll lose it. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis.
Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis.
Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis.
6 years ago today, Michael Brown, a young unarmed black man, was shot and killed by a police officer in the streets of Ferguson, Missouri. Though questions still remain about what happened that day, the protests and the movement that it sparked have changed the course of civil rights in the U.S. Brittany Farrell is a St. Louis-based activist and organizer for the political advocacy group Black Futures Lab. NewsHour weekend correspondent Yvette Feliciano spoke with her about the Ferguson protests and about how the killing of Michael Brown led us to where we are today.
So first off, I want to ask you, to take us back to 2014. How did the shooting of Michael Brown initially impact the Ferguson community, and how did it change your life?
I was actually in New York on a vacation with some peers that I was currently at the time in undergrad with. I found out about Mike Brown's murder when I opened up Twitter, and another peer of mine who was here had tweeted, "Ferguson Police Department just shot and killed an unarmed black boy." And it was that moment that I was just instantly glued to my phone. Even from hundreds of miles away, the grief and the pain and the anger that the community was feeling was palpable. Like, it was so strong, the response that folks had to such an atrocious act of violence. That is what urged me to book my trip home the very next day. It rocked our communities. It rocked our communities. And when people here gathered to grieve, and when folks were met with violence, the response to that from the community, the response to the police violence from the community was that, "We're not going to let you kill us in the street and then tell us that we can't grieve." And it was that response that sent this ripple effect around the world, where the civil rights movement that we are now living in has emerged from.
What are your thoughts about how the media covered the protests? Many people outside of Ferguson saw images of fires and destruction to property, and viewed the protests largely as riots. How is that different from what you saw and experienced on the ground?
The framing of our movement, the framing of our uprising at that time, they needed to control the narrative. So in order to do that, they pit the protesters, peaceful demonstrators, folks who were having vigils, who were met with violence, as the rioters, as the looters, as the dangerous ones, and the police were framed as being heroic, trying to save the community from destroying their own community. It was very clear what they were trying to do. We see it today, right? When Donald Trump, he calls the protesters rioters and looters. It's a very important part of his message, because it gives validation to the fact that federal agents get to snatch people off the streets and no one should be concerned about it. Like, it's a repetitive theme that I believe the media in the past has used a lot and that people get to hold on to continue to perpetuate this narrative that police are necessary, violence against protesters is necessary because all they do is riot and loot. There's no purpose and for them being out in the streets, and that's just inaccurate. And I'm actually very happy to see now, 6 years later, that people are beginning to see how inaccurate that actually is.
Back in 2014, former officer, police officer Darren Wilson was not indicted for Michael Brown's killing, and he was cleared of any civil rights violations. What impact did that have on your activism and on the national movement that was sparked by this incident?
I felt a sense of rage and anger and deep sadness and grief all at the same time. And it was in that moment that I knew for the rest of my life, my work was going to be geared towards fighting for the justice and dignity and power for Black communities. And I have been on that same trajectory since then. Ever since the non-indictment came out in November of 2014, folks here, and I would feel safe to say around the globe, have not stopped mobilizing, have not stopped moving in pursuit of justice for Black people in this country.
We're once again in a period of widespread protests surrounding the killings of unarmed Black people by the police. You know, 6 years later, why are we back here again? Is there anything about this moment that feels different to you?
Yes. This moment, it feels different, definitely. We have shifted in how we interrogate power over the past 6 years, and we have also began to reimagine justice. It's no longer arrest the cops that killed Breonna Taylor. It's also defund the police and invest money into communities that need that type of investment. Black communities, invest in things to help Black people thrive.
How do you sustain a movement such as Black Lives Matter? What more needs to happen to truly shift policy and people's consciousness?
I believe that this movement is going to continue moving forward because we have to. We know that the only other option at this point, what it looks like, is we are on the pathway to a dictatorship. America is falling into fascism. Is that what we want for our country? Absolutely not. I think that we have no other choice but to organize around the message, Black Lives Matter, because we know that if Black folks have justice in this country, everybody has justice in this country.
Brittany Farrell of Black Futures Lab, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Context of White Supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, August 15, 2020, so I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have counter-racist suggestions, thoughts, observations, the number 720-716-7300, the code 564-943 pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 720-716-7300, the code 564-943 pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Lots to cover. We will try to get in as much as possible. This week's compensatory call-in made it back to Seattle safely after the COWS counter-racist yoga retreat in Washington, D.C. Best banana pudding ever after last week's program. Wish I had that to look forward to this week. Man, so delicious. In fact, it was twice as delicious. It was amazing the first time, and it was even better the next day, once the cookies got soft, we had homemade Nilla wafers in the banana pudding. Absolutely amazing. Whew. Anywho, so for this week, sans banana pudding, I had a person email me, and this happens all the time, and said, "Hey there, Gus, brother Gus, could you suggest or give me a list of books that you think would be helpful to read to understand racism, white supremacy?" I get this question all the time, have for many, many years. I never answer it. I will reply sometimes, but I never answer it. I don't take that question very seriously. This is why. Well, there are many reasons, but I don't take it very seriously. Number one, Dr. Francis Cress Welsing was asked that very question on a live broadcast of The Cows. And her response was, "Read them all." She didn't give out an answer at all. She just said, "Read them all." And she said, "Hey, there's lots to know. We are poorly informed about all kinds of things. Read them all. Get as many as you can." And I've heard Mr. Fuller give almost an exact, like verbatim exact same response when asked that question. It wasn't on The Cows. It was I think it might have been a live lecture that he was doing, but where he gave the same response. Just read them all. You know, so much to know. We've been misinformed about so many things. Read them all. So that's one. One of the other, and the list is lengthy, reasons that I don't really have a specific response, and I don't really take the question or that question too seriously when it's posed to me. I don't think one can listen to the context of white supremacy even like halfway. If you kind of tune in and tune out, like, I kind of listen to this coon. Woo, let's see what's on Netflix. Okay, I'll tune in and listen about 30 minutes. Oh, okay, that was all right. Yeah, that's pertinent. Even if you did that, you would hear a lot of books mentioned. Not to mention, we have a book club. I don't think there are too many people who can truthfully say, I have read all of the books that have been suggested on The Cows, all of the books written by all of the authors that have come on The Cows over the years, all of the books that have been read on the book club or that just get mentioned. I don't think any listener can truthfully say that. That's why I said, like, if you listen to The Cows at all, even you listen to an episode like once a month or so, there is no way you're not going to have a list of books. Like, in fact, even I'm just looking at this past week. So we had the yoga retreat, disrupted the schedule, missed some programs just this past 7 days. So we'll skip over the book club, right? We'll just, just the compensatory call-in from last Saturday, Isabel Wilkerson, Cased. That's one. Now, that's a brand new book, so it's probably a really, really short list of people who can truthfully say, "Oh, yeah, I already read Case." Boom, knock that out. What else you got? So that would at least be one. And that's probably a twofer, because I suspect some folks were not with us way back in 2013 when we read Isabel Wilkerson, The Warmth of Other Suns, a book I mention all the time as being in my top 10. That would be another one. So that one, you could either listen in the book club or you could, I get it myself. I can read. No problem. Go check it out. That's what I mean. Like, we kind of mention books all the time on this broadcast. So there's no way you could say, "Well, yeah, I've read all that stuff. What else you got?" If you have, make sure you hit the references as you are plowing through all of those books, because they mention a lot of other books that are spectacular to read. I'll also make sure that I get in. We have a book club with the context of white supremacy. I know the archives have been disrupted, and it, you know, it's a real challenge to get everything uploaded once again. But I mean, even the last 4 or 5 years of the book club, I think, is accessible, available. Our book club has been poorly attended since its inception. Many people, you know, variety of reasons, because we started out, we didn't even do audiobooks. We did, you know, we'll read on our own. We'll just do 50 pages or so and then tune in and share. And lots of people said, for a lot of reasons, racist man, racist woman, disruptions, offspring, all kinds of things, but just not able to keep up with the reading. So we couldn't do that. So we switched to the audio format. That way everybody can just tune in, participate, and we're all at the same spot in the book. That is poorly attended. So poorly attended that I had thought of even canceling the book club several times throughout the years, because people do not participate. They don't keep up. They don't, you know, read the book seriously. We have lots of folks who deviate into tangents because they're not really following along with the text. They don't have the book to follow along, so they're just deviating off into tangents and things. Even if you just look to see which books are being read in the book club, you could read them on your own. But again, for many, that's even ignoring the tons of authors that have been on the program over the years. There is no way, there is no way you could be a Cows listener, even casually, and have a void of literature to check out. This even gives me one more opportunity to talk about reading. Now, even if you don't listen to the Cows, even if you just followed on social media, I tend to post a lot about books. I have written book reviews, all kinds of things. We'll even post books that I find for free online from time to time. So within the past couple of months, I posted a picture of some of my books that I own on my bookshelves. I posted this picture. The point that I wanted to make was it's about 150 books. I'm looking at those very shelves right now. Approximately 150 books. All of them talking about white supremacy, racism. Racism and or white supremacy is in the title of exactly five books out of 150, approximately. And it might be a little more than 150, but certainly no less than, we'll say, 140 or so. But racism, and I mean talking about racism, white supremacy all over the world in different parts, rape and drugs and prisons and entertainment racism and AIDS racism and medical apartheid and all kinds of environmental racism and anything you can think of, zombie Negroes, anything you can think of, Katrina, Planet of the Apes, anything you can think of. Racism, white supremacy is in the title. Racism and or white supremacy is in the title of exactly five books. And I posted this to say that, man, that is a part of the problem. We are not speaking very directly, even though these books are addressing racism, white supremacy. That's what they're all talking about. It's not being addressed in a very direct manner. White supremacy in the title of only one book, and that is Stephen Kantrowitz, Ben Tillman, and the Reconstruction of White Supremacy, which we read in the Cows Book Club. In fact, Gus T. Renegade narrated in the Cows Book Club, and even add a little bit on, in the summer of Dylan Storm Roof's massacre. That was what inspired us to read that book at that very time. All of that to say, so I post that again. Wow, we don't talk. People, when we talk about racism, it's not being addressed directly. When I posted that online, it ended up being all this, you know, like I'm bragging about, I don't know, owning these books or reading these books or something way far from, wow, racism is only in the title of five of these books? That's kind of crazy. Like, wow, that kind of got lost in all of it. And incidentally, I am not aware of what planet, time period, culture, like I am not aware of where one can go out and brag and get like kudos and be thought well of because you own and or have read books. Like, I don't know what universe is that. Like, I'm accustomed to people like posting how much money they have or their shiny new car or their 12 bedroom mansion. I have never heard of, we check out this bookcase here. How many of y'all got homes? Like, are they bound in leather? Like, I don't know what universe that is where people, especially a black person, where they care about you or want to give you a high five or a hug or a soul clap or anything because you have read 5 pages or 5 billion pages. Like, I am not aware of that at all. But anyway, reading is more important than watching television, and I think that is emphasized regularly. We had bookmarks to give out at the Cal's yoga retreat. I think that's emphasized regularly on this here broadcast. So anybody, if you are looking out for books to read, have your pen, pad, tablet at the ready. Books will be mentioned on the Cal's. Next. We had a person email in. So last week, B in Toronto, she tuned in and she said, what, you know, code do people have for emergencies, you know, economics, their health, all of that. You know, we've had an unprecedented year thus far and probably more ugliness to come. What sort of code do people have? So we had a listener. She wrote in. She says, Dear Gus, what I'm doing to maintain my economic health? Question. Paying all my bills, rent in a month in advance. Saving money from every day, from every paycheck, at least a couple of $100s. Spending my time listening to news, reading, taking care of my children, listening to the Cal's archives, and listening to Mr. Fuller's show weekly. Not going out very often. Health. Continuing to follow a vegan diet. Woo! Love that one. Talked all about that at the Counter-Racist Yoga Retreat. Trying to maintain consuming fruits and vegetables daily. That is all we did at the Counter-Racist Yoga Retreat. Drinking water or seltzer water. We didn't do seltzer water, but we did water at the yoga retreat. Eating whole grains. Did lots of that. Minimizing vegan sweets. Now, we did have vegan banana pudding and sweet potato pie and pineapple upside down cake. So we did have sweets, but even with the sweets, we did still have an emphasis on fruits, veggies, you'll notice, but we did have, you know, delish. My report for the week. I lost power over a week due to Tropical Storm Isaias, which hit New York on August 4th. Con Ed is the electric company that supplies electricity to all of New York City. I live in Queens. I also live in a family home that includes my parents and youngest brother living in an apartment. My brother and his partner and their offspring are living in an apartment, and myself, my partner, and two offspring, ages 12 and 1, are living in an apartment. We called the company the same day it happened to report the outage. My parents were optimistic about our lights being restored in 2 to 3 days. We live in a majority black area. I almost feel like they should have the thematic music right there, like majority black area. Dun, dun, dun. This is not going to go well. I had to explain to my parents that Con Ed will fix white areas first. There we go. Logic. First, so we will be without power for some time. That's it. Correct expectations. That's what you want. My partner and I spent a lot of time looking for generators or a way to restore some power. We found one on August 6th and purchased it. However, it had so many hazardous signs on it, people are at risk for carbon monoxide and dioxide poisoning if the device is not 5 feet away from the windows. It also cannot be operated in the rain due to increased risk for a fatal shock. It runs on gas, so my partner and my brother had to constantly obtain fuel. It's extremely loud. Finally, the machine seemed to use 1 gallon per hour, which is not what was advertised on the package. We ended up returning it on August 8th. Con Ed sent a person to survey the damages the same day the generator was returned, August 8th. We started getting the text messages and emails from Con Ed stating that our power would be repaired from August 9th to August 12th. From August 9th to August 11th, we kept seeing Con Ed staff come to our area and basically surveying the area. My mom had an especially difficult time tolerating this situation. She cursed people that worked for Con Ed several times on the phone and the people she saw surveying. I told her that we need to be patient because Con Ed does not see our area as a priority. On August 10th, my mom spoke to one of the Con Ed staff observing the area. A non-white black male told her that the Con Ed staff is working to fix white neighborhoods first and sending them just to make it seem like something will be done soon. I wonder, was that a staff person? Did I read that? was this a black male who works actually for Con Ed who said that? Like, wow, that is, she should write in and give him like a 2 thumbs up. Like, he gave them, you know, excellent customer service, was frank and honest. You can write and complain about Con Ed too, but like, he should get a sterling recommendation. You don't have to say what he said or anything like that. Just, he did a great job. He was frank, honest, that this is the type of customer service that Con Ed and everyone else should strive to emulate. So they put that in his service record. Maybe he can get a raise if that's what happened. Okay. He also said that the white contractors will most likely be doing the job. He recommended that we call Con Ed repeatedly and or report this to the media. They fixed our area on August 12th, and it was white contractors who did it. My family's plans are to start preparing for emergencies after this situation. We plan to set up an emergency area in our home that will include equipment to help us maintain power, cook, and store food. Does anyone have suggestions on generators that are emission-free? What are you doing to be prepared for emergencies? Stay safe. Vegan. Love it. Love it. Love it. Love it. Great questions. Great recommendations. I think definitely if you have offspring, I think you have to be getting all of those things in order, because you definitely, if you have, and particularly young children, a 1-year-old, even 12-year-old, you know, anybody really, if you didn't have children, to kind of have those things organized, because you don't want to be stuck in that sort of situation and knowing you're not a priority. We've seen this so many times, Hurricane Katrina. Your black life does not matter. We'll get to you next week, maybe. So absolutely, water necessities, so that you can cook, so that you can store food, have water, all the, you know, necessities, and for, I think some people, I think for a lot of folks, they would say at least having 2 to 4 weeks of supplies, if not longer, in case something of that nature happens, so that you can sustain yourselves and have some semblance of normalcy. But absolutely, like, that is critical, and particularly in this type of year, to have that sort of thing happen where it, maybe you can go to the grocery store, maybe you can't go to the grocery store to get supplies. You know, it's one thing if the power goes out or whatever, and you can just run to the store and you can get food, you can get everything really quick, no big deal, and everything is fine. You can even get ice and all of that. But I mean, with the chaos that has been this year, you might not even be able to do those things. Certainly, it might be more cumbersome, more challenging to do those things than if this type of thing had happened last year, if it had just been a power outage in the summer of 2019. Lots to codify. If folks have suggestions on hazard-free generators, emission-free generators, that would be great to know. We were flying into, or at least I was flying into D.C. right as I think Hurricane Isaias was clearing. Like, as I was landing, it was like the clouds were breaking, the sun was coming out, but the ground was wet. You could see that it had just rained, and I had just been seeing that they had been getting the warnings for Isaias like the previous day. But I think we got there on the 4th. It had just cleared and was going to wreak havoc as a tropical storm further north. But codification. Next, Global Sunday broadcast, Global Sunday Talk on Racism will be here tomorrow, 3 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Central, 12 noon Pacific. We'll be good to check in with folks about lots of things that are happening in the world, the virus. Just saw a report where they were talking about Brazil is ripe for experimentation. That was the languaging that they were using. because they have so many cases and, you know, so much chaos and things, and they are wanting to try to get a wrap on this that ripe for experimentation. They have a lot of poor people, black people, even though they didn't say black people, got a lot of poor people. Global Sunday Talk will be here tomorrow. Looking forward to checking in with folks in the AFWR, I guess, depending on where you are on the globe, checking in with folks tomorrow. We are listener-supported, counter-racist radio. Invest if you think the cows is constructive, if it has helped you get a better understanding of what it means to be white, what white supremacy racism is, how it works. You can visit the blog racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. PayPal button is linked right there. We are also on Cash App, cash.app/thecows. Much obliged to all the folks who have invested, supported for 11 and a half years. Hope the program has been, continues to be worthy of your time and energy. Let's see. Also, Kamala Harris, we have the election. She was picked this week to be vice or former vice president. Joe Biden, be his running mate, his potential VP. What do folks think about her selection? Thoughts for the election coming up? I guess that'll be a greater focus as we get closer to November. Can't believe it's almost, the debates, I guess, will be here September, so we'll chat about that. I guess we'll talk about that tomorrow on the Global Sunday Talk as well, but if folks have any thoughts on that, feel free to share. The portion that they talked about, I guess it was one of the earlier news reports where they talked about younger people going out and partying and going to bars and all of that, not taking this seriously and contracting the virus. And they said that there are so many unhealthy young people here because they don't eat well, they don't exercise, they don't take care of themselves, that they might be, you know, 29, 31, whatever it is, but chronologically, they are substantially older, and explaining, you know, how not taking care of yourself, not eating well, that erodes your health, makes you more susceptible to these types of problems. The Cows Yoga Retreat, and that's something that we've talked about regularly, and I thought that was extremely important because the system of white supremacy is designed to see that black people, non-white people, but black people especially, have advanced beyond their chronological years. Medical apartheid, they got lots of the, have we been talking about that all year long? A terrible thing to waste. That's what I mean about those books. A terrible thing to waste. We can talk about this all year long. Packing them in, we've been talking about this all year long, especially on the book club. But everything about this system is designed to see that black people are not in good health. That's what I mean about taking the virus serious. Make sure that I take this moment to, again, any of the folks, you don't think that there is a COVID-19, you don't think that there is a coronavirus, you are saying things that suggest we not take it seriously, you are not welcome. You're not a doctor, you're not a physician, you're not a medical professional. I don't care what your perspective is, really, on the virus, what you think people should do, if we should take it seriously. You are entitled to your opinion. Whoopee. But saying things that suggest we not take this seriously are still not welcome. It is a tad embarrassing to have to keep saying that, but that is where we are in the only country, unless I am misinformed, still the only so-called country in the world where people are out protesting. I'm not going to wear a mask. Ain't no Rona. We'll double check that tomorrow, but we've asked repeatedly and talked to folks around the world. Reigning, the only spot in the globe We're not endorsing that, so you'll just have to find another program. If that's your position, don't need a mask, no need to take this seriously, this is a bunch of phooey, make sure you tune into something other than the cows. Let's see. Even connecting that with the portion where they talked about the victims of white supremacy, so-called rappers, hip-hop entertainers, man, really pitiful indictment of white supremacy there. You do all that rapping, do all that gyrating, made white people all that money, and you can't get any sort of health package? They don't have Obamacare for the hip-hoppers? They don't do that? Man, we had mind playing tricks on you. Scarface, COVID-19 victim, talked about having permanent damage to his kidneys. Talked about that earlier this year. Apparently they don't have good health benefits for MCs. That might be a deterrent to being in that field. Let's see. Pause there. This is the one broadcast where we request if we could not use metaphors. Lots of ways that race soldiers, they will employ similes, analogies, to practice deception, master deceivers. Victims of white supremacy, myself included, we have been exposed to this deception for centuries, years. And many of us, myself included, we are still learning. As such, sometimes we substitute logic for an analogy. We don't have logic. You know, we're still thinking, haven't come to a conclusion yet. So we'll substitute, insert an analogy, comparison of some sort for evidence. And often this just creates a lot of confusion. If we could be direct, exact, specific on what we want to say, that would be appreciated. I will prompt about the metaphors. Much obliged. And if you need more time to articulate your thoughts, that is always encouraged and allowed. Grand. If folks could take about 5 minutes to share their thoughts, observations, that would be great. Just make sure that everybody gets at least one chance to speak. If you have additional thoughts, that is great. Just make sure that everyone gets one chance to speak first, and then you can return and add your additional thoughts, questions, observations. If you know you are in a noisy environment, if you could use your mute button, that would be super appreciated. Just helps so that we don't have to compete with a lot of unnecessary background noise. You can kind of get to a quiet area and share your thoughts, and then you can mute your line. And then if you want to talk more, you can unmute and join us again. Super helpful. The Chicago situation I thought was important this week as well. These type of incidents where you have property destruction, violence against enforcement officers, because that was reported in Chicago. These type of incidents, I think if they continue to happen as it gets closer to the election, all of that will fuel the narrative of why we end up having 4 more years. Just my thought. I could be in error, but certainly dangerous times, and just more of a reason why I would say try to hunker down. Not the best year to be out and about. I certainly would not be out and about participating in any of the protests and what have you, because it just seems very susceptible to unpredictable events, violence situations where non-white people could be harmed who should not be harmed, and that's what we're trying to stop to begin with. Number again, 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Also, I'm going to have to go about getting a new computer soon, so hopefully the cows has been worthy that Gus T can get a new computer. Looks like I'm having major computer problems, which has been just added to the wackiness of 2020, but new computer on the horizon for Gus T. I've gotten a lot of work out of my MacBook that I got, via fundraising way back in 2010 has held up pretty well over all this time. But yes, it is probably time for an upgrade new computer. See if we can get that as well. Anywho, first few folks who dialed in, *61 if you would like to participate. We'll nab hands as we go. Hopefully folks are not spectating in the midst of all the chaos. And particularly if you have any suggestions about that generator and or your code for emergencies, especially parents, please share. Much obliged again to our vegan listener for sharing all that great information. But tips on generators, tips on your counter-racist code for emergencies and all the rest, and or other observations, thoughts to share. First few lines that have a hand up. Line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Henry, in Chicago. Yes, sir.
All right. Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers and listeners. Yes, I agree. There is no way you can suggest a list of books on racism, white supremacy. There's a whole bunch of books out there, a plethora of books, and you could just basically kind of read, you know, just like they said, read all of them and then, you know, put your own conclusion together on what racism, white supremacy is. But the more you read, the more you kind of uncover a lot of what this system is. So, you know, I wouldn't even put a limit on it. Just read as many as you can. Situation in Chicago. Apparently, with that situation with the guy getting shot by the police and stirring up the rioting and looting that happened in downtown in the north side, it started Sunday afternoon when the police officer shot a non-white black male in the neighborhood called Inglewood. And what ended up happening was Black Lives Matter tried to come into the Inglewood neighborhood, but apparently the residents in the Inglewood neighborhood did not want them there because they knew that they were going to stir up something that they did not want in their neighborhood. Now, understand that Inglewood is one of the places where a lot of shootings happen here in Chicago. And what ended up happening was there were hundreds of police officers that basically came to Inglewood like in a matter of minutes to kind of because there was something forming after this man got shot. And apparently, from what some of the residents said, that he actually had a shootout with the police, and the police ended up shooting him. So we have questions if the shooting was even unjustifiable. At that point, when the residents and also the police that came down to Inglewood, you know, barricaded the protest, later on that night, around midnight, they stormed into downtown Chicago and on the north side and kind of looted those places. Now, over the week, they arrested a lot of the looters who basically got caught on camera, who basically did Facebook Lives, you know, going into these stores. And what was so interesting is I believe there were about 30 or 40 arrests from these, you know, looters, and none of them lived in Inglewood. None of them had any ties to Inglewood. So that was, you know, a pretty interesting situation. And speaking of this looting and rioting, and you were just talking about the election, I got a feeling that there's got to be some preparation going on with all this rioting, because I feel like after the election, whether Trump wins or not, there's going to be some major riots in the city. And there's going to be major riots everywhere, I think, you know, whether Trump wins or not. And I just feel like we have to be prepared for that, because I think the riots that happen after the election will probably be a lot worse than what we've been seeing over this, you know, over these past couple of weeks. So it is, you know, I think we ought to start preparing for emergency planning, getting probably generators, because they're probably going to start cutting the power off in some of these cities, you know, as an emergency action. You know, probably stock up on food and water for, you know, maybe for a couple of weeks. Go, you know, get armed and just in case, you know, in a codified way, you know, so you would, you know, in case you have to leave your house and, you know, you might have to, you know, go somewhere, because obviously Black people will always get displaced. So, you know, in that type of situation, you know, you want to be prepared for that. So, that's all I have right now in my life.
Much obliged, Henry in Chicago. Appreciate the observations in Chicago. I feel like we've heard that before, where they have some sort of looting or unrest, and the people that are participating don't live there. I feel like we've heard that type of report before, but I think the great suggestions about being prepared, I think it should go without saying, do not participate. You don't want to be out there running around and anything like that. They got cameras, drones, and all the rest. Do not participate. I do not think that is constructive at all, being engaged in that. And I could easily see these becoming more dangerous, as Henry in Chicago said, as things continue with this year. So, yeah, be prepared. Have have supplies, water, food. Our caller mentioned, if folks have any tips on that generator. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in, *61 if you have commentary. Folks with a hand up, proceed. Oh, was that one person? Mind playing tricks on me. Let's see. Oh, I thought I did hear someone. Did I hear someone? Okay. Get the rest of the folks on the switchboard. Don't even have.
Hello?
Oh, okay. See, I did. Yes, ma'am. We can hear you.
Okay. Great. Good evening, everyone. You see now. Oh, I think that was it. Gus, I had sent you some emails. I don't know if you received them. I think the first email is about Jamaica in the 70s. I think U.S. government trying to destabilize Jamaica in the 70s, and I was asking you if you could have that, the author of that article on the program. Does that sound familiar or no?
Was this the author that was talking about Dr. Perry using the dogs in Jamaica, or a different?
No, this is different. It's a different article. Author, I sent you an article,
okay.
And it's a different author.
Oh,
I also sent you an article about Denmark destroying ghettos.
That was recent.
Yeah, I sent that one. Yeah, I sent. Okay, all right. Cool. And I also, I think you brought up Kamala Harris and the presidential election, and I find it very interesting that it's the way the media is portraying her, I guess, her electability, or why Biden chose her, is because she was friends with his son, and also very much I think they're playing up her Indian background more than her Jamaican background, and selling that. I don't know if you're trying to, delve a bit more into that
quote unquote age and demographic. But I think Biden also called her honorary Biden, or something like that he had said. But I feel like very much like, you know, she's been used as a tool. And I think that's it. Thanks.
Honorary Biden? Like, what does that mean? Like, what? I've never heard that before. Like, honorary Biden? I don't, reminds me of honorary white, which is in the word guide as a term that should not be used. But I don't know. I can't even begin. Like, what was the response? Like, this was a public. Did anybody question? Like, what does that mean? Honorary Biden?
No. It was an article on NPR website, and honorary Biden was in quotes, and that's the first thing that came to my mind was honorary white. That's the first thing that came to my mind. But it was. It almost seemed like it was supposed to be a compliment, like she was a part of the family. That's how the article, I guess, made it seem. But it made me question, you know. Why even say that? What does that even mean?
Words are important. That is something that we are supposed to be paying attention to, really, in counter racism, period, but particularly on the compensatory call-in. And I can't even begin to pick it up other than honorary white. And I don't hear, like, I paid attention kind of to 2016 campaign, lock her up, I remember that, right? You predicted a winner. I don't remember them saying that Mike Pence is an honorary Trump. Like, did you all, I don't remember hearing that. Did I, maybe I missed that. Maybe I didn't hear it. In fact, I kind of paid attention to the 2008 election and the 2012 a little bit. I don't remember Joe Biden being described as an honorary Obama. Did I miss that? Maybe I didn't. I wasn't paying attention. I was listening to now. I wasn't listening to NPR in 2008, but I was by 2012. I don't remember a report. You know, we got an honorary Obama in the family now. He's a little pale, but he is one of the family. Joe Biden. I mean, what? What? And that metaphor again, the family. I have to check it out. I checked NPR, but I missed that one. If anybody has a thought on that one, you can share as well. Honorary Biden, Kamala Harris. Let's see. Other folks, if you have commentary, I'll get in. Again, we will be here tomorrow, Global Sunday Talk on Racism, 3 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Central, 12 noon Pacific. We'll chat it up with folks in different parts of the globe, see what is happening with the protest, the Rona, honorary Biden. They heard that one around the world. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Retired firefighter in Florida. Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings, everyone. I already have spoken on a couple of things over the course of the near the end of the week. My offspring will be coming off of self quarantine Monday. I would arrange for him to come back up on this side of Miami-Dade County, and I think I would also have him to take a test just to make sure. All of this is precaution. In my understanding, there's absolutely nothing wrong with him at all. And he's just been relaxing at his aunt's house. That's behind the house that I grew up in. Other than that, Friday, this past Friday, I went to what is called a viewing. I do not like to look at dead bodies. I've had to do that on a job when the person was either dying or seconds or minutes after death. And it bothers me to do so, but, you know, out of relationships with other people, I sometimes do it just to make peace, I guess. But anyway, in this particular case, it was the daughter of a lady who supported us, myself and a few other guys, when we were making attempts to neutralize the system of racism and white supremacy back in the 80s and the 90s. She was, as I mentioned before, shot to death in Baltimore. I even wondered, I thought she was already, you know, burial already took place. But apparently, because she grew up in Miami-Dade County, they brought her remains back here, and the viewing and whatnot. And she also was pregnant at the time, and they delivered the dead child from her and placed the child in the casket also. I mentioned about all of the parts of my observation just to keep a reminder to us about the idea of this slogan that is identified as Black Lives Matter, it starts with us. What was the other thing that you were mentioning about, Gus, as far as something about emergency or something you were saying at the beginning?
It went back to last week, I believe. B in Toronto had asked about what sort of code people have for an emergency, and we had a listener. She wrote in. She's a parent. And she wrote in about her code for health in terms of what she's eating, what she's not eating, drinking more water. And she talked about how they lost power at her residence for about a week or so because of Hurricane Isaiah this past week. And they were saying because of that event, it made them say, hey, we got to look at our code for what should happen if there's an emergency like this and we lose power, getting a generator. They got one, but it didn't work well and had a lot of health hazards. So she wanted to know if people had could recommend a quality generator that does not have any hazardous potential side effects, doesn't emit a lot of fumes and that sort of thing. And if people have a code in place, if there is that type of emergency, I would think someone who lives in Hurricane Alley might have to be a bit more prepared for that sort of thing.
Yes, sir. It started with me with the fire department, actually. Even before, it was a practice, even back when I was a small child in the 60s, that the preparedness for hurricanes was a quote-unquote culture down here because it was, you know, so frequent. I think it's something that should be practiced. Whoever is the figure who you know, pays the bills or whatever, that sort of thing, just make it some like a one-month practice of an inventory of necessary
food that you would have stored in a maybe some sort of clean box or I'm trying to think of one of those things made out of plastic that you can get from Kmart or something like that, where you can store canned goods and that sort of thing, fresh water, and each month kind of like take an inventory of it, because some of it may have spoiled, it may have been a crack in the preserves or something like that, and just, you know, be repetitious about it, you know, from that standpoint. Check that generator. It is a device that needs checking on, because you don't want it to not perform when it is actually needed. I would do that maybe, you know, once a month, you know, once every 2 weeks, something like that. Just a matter of, you know, being organized in that light. So when things do go to that point that you're prepared, and it also places you in a different mental state also, because you know you have done certain things on a continuous basis. So when something really takes place that you're not, you know, you know, that sort of thing, you feel that you are prepared, because you actually are, you know, from that standpoint. But yeah, those are just some things, and you know, and place them on paper, place them on your computer. Well, the computer breaks down, place them on paper in plastic, you know, because, you know, water does destroy things. So you would know what to do, when to do it, and how to do it. And I just said talk real fast during my 5 minutes, but that basically is some ideas that can that you can do, you know, in just about any type of emergency, natural or otherwise. yeah, and check your. If you have firearms, check your firearms. Make sure that they're in a place where water is not contaminating their use, that sort of thing, because natural or otherwise, you're going to need it. You're going to need it, because people run out of stuff, and the first thing that people do that run out of stuff, they go looking for other people's things. You know, so you want to be able to divert from that. And, you know, same thing with your vehicles, too. And that's about it. Thank you.
Excellent advice from retired firefighter and a Florida resident. So excellent advice. Cooler, I think that was it. Well, you can go get one of those, have some things there, but great, have that list, check it. You can make that a little monthly activity, just go over the inventory and check on your canned goods, if you have dry goods. I know for myself as a plant-based person, I eat a lot of fresh produce. I kind of turn my nose up at frozen produce and even frozen canned goods. But man, oh man, if the power goes out and you can't cook anything for a while, buddy, can of oranges might look like heaven after you've gone a week or so and not had anything to eat. I was also going to say you could have peanut butter. Man, oh, man.
Oh, yeah.
I said,
oh, yeah.
When the Rona first hit, I had a 9-pound bucket of peanut butter that had just arrived. And I said, bingo, there we go, right on time. Had a lot of rice, too, but you need power for that. But, I mean, if you have peanut butter, you can get, like, some loaves of bread and just have that in the freezer. Do exactly what a retired firefighter says. You check your inventory. If the power goes out, pull that bread out within a few hours. I mean, at max a day or so, peanut butter, bread. I mean, you'll have minimums. You can have peanuts. You can get that in bulk. There's certain things like you can get nuts and, as I said, dry fruits and things that you can just have in bulk. Wham, water or water filters and or water. Just have that ready. I would guess 2020 nowadays, it might be good to have, like, phone batteries, and they even have some of those phone chargers that where you can kind of keep your devices charged. Might be nice if you can keep your phone charged even while the power is out. I could see where that could be pretty helpful in addition to firearms and all. But
Definitely. Because particularly now, like I said, beforehand, this maybe wouldn't have been as big a deal. I mean, you could have seen, I have lived through events where there was no power, but like Walmart's was still open. You could still go to Costco or Sam's Club and, you know, stock up, get whatever you need, batteries, blah, 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 that sort of thing. No big deal. With the Rona, maybe, maybe not. I would not want to take that chance with all of this. I think it would just really, really behoove us to be prepped, at least have the basics, especially if you are an attempted parent, like underline, boldface, print, the listener who wrote in, B as well, in Toronto, both parents. If you have offspring, like mandatory.
got a question, Gus.
Oh, let's hear it.
Did we read Charles Phillips' book?
We did not read it like on the book club collectively. I had to read it individually to prep for him as a guest, but we didn't read it like on the book club.
Okay. I was in that case, then, being that you read it, you probably have a personal consensus of it. I think it's something that would be a good read. Anyway, just an idea. That's it.
See what I mean? See what I mean? Talked about that before. Reading more important than watching television. Fighting more than fires. Charles Phillips, guest on the program and author. Let's see. Number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Others,
can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings, callers and listeners. Thank you again, Gus, once again for the platform. Just answering some of the questions and some of the compensatory notes that I have. Addressing first the emergency aspect, as an attempted parent myself, I've done a lot of what Be in Toronto has spoken about. I'm still working on the vegan side. It's very difficult to get everybody in the household on the same page with that, but that's always a work in progress. The next thing I've done, though, is I've bought camping gear, backpacks, rain jackets, hiking boots, headlights, anything of the sort that if I had to be outside for a duration of time that I could definitely manage and not be in a distressful position, as well as staying active, being able to at least run for certain distances, jumping rope and working out and such forth. Those are extremely important at the end of the day, because you could have all the equipment you want, but if you don't have your health, it just really doesn't matter. And leading into that, one of the good things coming from the gentleman that was speaking, the non-white male journalist, about the rap artist Malik B passing recently, and also speaking about the other artist, Sean Price, located in New York and Brooklyn. In my area, which is a non-white area, they recently just had a very big push, and it was actually today where they closed off a whole entire block and had a lot of non-white people promoting better health, working out, overall practices. They even had, since they closed off the block, they had weightlifting there. They had people jumping rope. They had people doing different types of calisthenics. Just exhibiting to the general public as they pass by different things that they could do to stay active, which I thought was really, really constructive. It was one of the good things I really saw today. And speaking about Kamala Harris, pardon me one second, it's a little loud in the background.
context of white supremacy. We'll be here.
Yeah, right past my front door. One of the things I speak about with Kamala Harris, as well as Malik B, which is something that I feel ties in with the system of racism, white supremacy, is that whites will use you to a certain extent to get to the level they want, to establish more power and amass more wealth. And then when they're finished with you, dump you. And I don't think that's a metaphor in this sense, just dump you right back to where you came from, if not into a further deep situation that you were in prior, or you might be in a deeper situation after they're finished utilizing you or using you, as I feel what they do. And that's the situation with Kamala Harris. I feel that it's very dangerous to be in that same position. The same thing with the rap artists. They get used and abused and thrown out to the streets just like everybody else. And I feel like VGQ, she's trying to do whatever she's trying to do. I can't speak for her, but that's one of the things that I see happening in these certain circumstances. Last but not least, I have to admit, I was another guilty party, Gus, that asked you what books I should read. And then I started looking on the podcast on iTunes and noticed how many sessions of book readings that you had, and I just started picking up stuff. And that being said, I did pick up two books today that arrived. Tommy J. Curry's Another White Man's Burden, Josiah Royce's Quest for Philosophy of Racial Empire, White Racial Empire. And another book I picked up was Badges Without Borders, Stuart Schrader, I believe. Going to check them out and see how they are and how much information I can get for them that is constructive. That's about it for me. Thank you again for your time and energy. Peace.
Reading is more important than watching television. Now, how many books have been mentioned just since we started the program today? Anywho, I did have a quick question, sir. You said it's been a little bit of a tussle to get the household in agreement with, the vegan, more plant-based eating. What has been the problem? What has been challenging?
One of the things I think is some of it is habit, and I think the other, force of habit of just the default when it's hard to find something to eat that's vegan is to go back to the standard. And that's where I'm trying to come in and see what I could find that's tasty, because I think that's the key. Something that's tasty that also is vegan, that people will be able, that, my household will feel suitable with, and not feel the need to go, let's just order some Thai food and get some shrimp and some lobster, whatever, and all this other stuff. I like food just as much as the next person. I go to Thai restaurants and Indian restaurants and all these other places too. But I think the most important mentality to establish with food is that ultimately you're trying to give yourself nutrition. The fact that it tastes good is also a positive, but you also have to bear in mind that you eat to live, not live to eat. And that's one of the primary things that's helped me. But I think that mentality will take a little time with the rest of my family.
Spectacular. Thank you so much for sharing. That is great information to know. I said, for some time since I've been talking about being plant-based and everything, and particularly cooking more, that for me, it is 1A and 1B, doesn't matter the order, taste good, nutrition, or the other way, nutrition, taste good. Like, I have taste buds for a reason. Things should taste good. We shouldn't eat the same thing every day. That's even part of a healthy diet. You want diversity, as they say. You don't want to just eat the same thing every day, but nutritious, yummy. If it's yummy, I will be more likely to eat it. So if it's healthy and tasty, best of all worlds. That is something that try to promote with the Cows Yoga Retreats. I said I want to be a meal prepper. I said that was something I was inspired to do, cooking for black people. We had lasagna at the retreat. Folks said it was great, even when had leftovers that were taken home to some folks who are not plant-based at all. Loved them some Popeye's chicken and all the rest of it. And the lasagna was given to them. They weren't even told that it was vegan. It was like, oh, we got lasagna. You didn't want some? Gave it to them, and they loved it. Just make it taste. And it happens to be, oh, this is just full of vegetables, not even the cheese. All of it is plant-based. We had, let's see, pizza that was out of control. I didn't hear any gripes about the pizza. I already said the banana pudding was legendary. We had pizza with handmade crust. It was like Pizza Hut crust because we didn't have a pizza pan, so we couldn't do the traditional. That was what I wanted to do, but we had pans, so we did pan pizza, all veggies, zucchini, mushrooms, broccoli, onions, fresh basil. I did not hear spinach. I did not hear one person gripe, complain. I did not see one plate where it was just piled up like, oh, my God, we got to eat this garbage. But not at all. Tasty, delicious. We had a carrot hot dog. You have children, the carrot hot dogs, they have been unanimously adored three times now. Every retreat, everybody love the carrot hot dogs. Like, oh my God, they are amazing. If you have, they look like hot dogs. They are easy. You can make a bunch of them at the beginning. I mean, you talk about easy, whammo. I love curry. I just made curry today. I had broccoli, mushrooms, purple cabbage. I had my peanut butter curry. Oh, absolutely amazing. Yeah. It's got a little bit of fresh. Like, it's tons of stuff. It's tons of stuff. We had pineapple upside down cake at the retreat. Like, there's no way anybody can say we are missing out on tastiness just because we are plant-based. That's impossible. Sweet potato pie, throwing down. Smoothies every day, like, it's no reason. If you have a good blender, that alone will take care of a whole lot of stuff right there. But, yeah,
well, plant-based. I got a part of that. That's what, one of the things I was going to ask you was, as far as the diversity when it comes to eating, I've heard some people comment and say that it's okay to eat certain meals, certain things the same time over and over again because it's okay for your stomach. But then I've heard other people say in regards to your the probiotics within your stomach that it's better to eat a more wide range of foods because it's better for your gut health. Like, those are the two arguments that I've heard. And yes, by the way, just to add in, the blender, I spent the money and bought a Ninja blender, and that is definitely one of the things that keeps my son, my offspring, he uses it almost every day or every other day. Like, I definitely recommend that to anybody who's trying to get on the path as well, and an air fryer.
Love my air fryer. I did not use it today, but I love my air fryer. I use it, I won't say daily, but I use it often. My blender, I use every day. You don't have to have a super spectacular blender. A Cows listener did get me a Vitamix. Ninja's nice, too. Those are great. We had that at the Florida retreat. You don't need, you know, a super pricey blender. If you have the nickels, if white people have allowed you to have them, that can be a super quality investment, something that you can have for years and make a lot of just phenomenal products, smoothies and everything. Like, I said that repeatedly, like, your offspring, just having access to that blender right there, it could totally change, like, their health and see, like, wow, I got to make sure I get a blender when I have my house set up and I'm, you know, so-called grown, get me a blender so I can have some smoothies and have fresh fruits and things as a part of my diet. Like, I would not have eaten nearly as much garbage if I just had a blender and fresh fruits and veggies. I would have had that in my diet on a, and that would have been raw fresh fruits and veggies in my diet on a regular basis. But just a blender, and then you can look online and you can just think of recipes that you like. I tell that to people all the time. Things that you like, lasagna, pizza, great. You can have all that stuff and make it plant-based. It'll still be spectacular. Banana pudding. You don't have to miss out on anything. We had freaking banana pudding with vanilla wafers. Other folks, if you have commentary, *61, if you would like to join in, please do not spectate and wait until the end of the program. If you think you have commentary
you would like to share, 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. We had macaroni and cheese at the retreat. I forgot. We had macaroni and you don't have to miss out on anything. All of the tasty, yummy things that you enjoy, you can still have. Other folks we've not
heard
from. Thomas in New York.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening to all the callers. What kind of cheese would you use for that, Gus?
Okay, so at the retreat, we had cheeseless macaroni and cheese, and this was done deliberately because you can end up in environments where they don't have great grocery stores, so you might not be able to get a quality cheese. So you can make cheeseless macaroni and cheese. I did not hear any gripes. In fact, I had someone email me who said immediately when they first tasted it, because we had the cheeseless macaroni and cheese with the carrot hot dog, he said, wow, I want the recipe for this cheeseless macaroni and cheese. I think you heard it was in the archives last week. I didn't give her the recipe. Not that I was being stingy, just, you know, lots. I had to get back to Seattle. I had lots of things on my mind. She said, where is that recipe, Gus? I got her that recipe for the cheeseless macaroni and cheese. Like, whew, it is super thick. Now, you can do it with cheese. They have lots of vegan cheeses. You're in New York, so it'll be super easy. They have, I brought Miyoko's cheese. I don't like dropping brands because, like, man. Miyoko's, they have a cheese. It's vegan. It's cashew-based. They have mozzarella, cheddar. They have different brands. They have other cheeses that are cashew-based. They have some that are soy-based. Follow Your Heart is really good. That one melts. I think that one is soy-based. Unfortunately, people don't like soy, but Miyoko's is cashew-based and organic. And so they have a lot of different. You can make it with cheese. You can go get those. Miyoko's, I like it. That's a higher-end brand. It costs a little bit more, but it melts. I used it on the pizza. I have pictures of that. I used it on the lasagna. It melts. You can use it just the way you use cheese, but you can use that in the macaroni and be cheesy. The cheeseless macaroni that I had was super cheesy, creamy, rich. We have pictures. Have fans.
Interesting, Gus. So I'm gonna have to. So I don't eat mac. I don't eat cheese. So I'm gonna have to tell my wife because they love mac. Man, I never seen people. Man, mommy making macaroni. You know, people were dancing. All right. But wow, interesting. I didn't know they could make nut cheese. I mean, amazing. I don't classify Kamala Harris as black. However, Joe Biden made it clear he's the authority on who's classified as black or collective. So whatever he says is what it is. Sarah Palin has been pulled down from Alaska to go after her. Very strategic move by the Republicans. They've been trying to convince us for the last few months that Joe Biden isn't a racist. Even though he has a 50-year record, we could pull up with racist vote after racist vote. And 50 years of racist commentary that we could just go and pull up right off of YouTube. But he's a Democrat, so black people will defend him if you talk bad about him. So now they want to convince us that District Attorney, now Senator Harris, doesn't have a long record of discriminating against exclusively black people in a district without that many black people. San Francisco, Oakland area. I don't know. This is a hard sell. I don't see this benefiting the Democrats at all. Shame on Con Edison in Queens. Also in Connecticut, no electricity still in some areas of Connecticut. Best thing for the writer to do is move to Manhattan, where we have our power lines underground. We don't have these problems, even though we can get a blackout if salt water gets underground. But that doesn't happen that often. The solution could be, it's called Tesla Firewall and Tesla Solar Roof. This should be able to give you power without electricity And with the Tesla solar roof, you should be able to sell back power to the electricity company at the end of the month. You should be getting a check back that could be positive money in your pocket. Look it up. It's costly, but it pays back because it increases your you can get paid back from the electrical company. Also, it increases your property value extensively because the roof, it's not like solar panels. It's the actual roofing tiles are the solar part. It could take up to a Category 3 hurricane. It's pretty sturdy. And from what I understand, this is something that a lot of people are getting. They put videos out on YouTube. They show their electrical bill at the end of the month after they put it on. And show how, you know, some people are getting back $49, some people $29, some people's bill is as low as $12 in California in the middle of the summertime where they run their air conditioner all day. So look it up. It doesn't have it. It's a battery, and the solar panels charge the battery during the day, and then once the sun goes down, the battery powers the house, and it kind of works that way without the electricity unless – the electricity is needed, then it kicks in. But it doesn't, I think, give any fumes or anything like that off. It's totally safe for the environment. It's made by, in my opinion, the world's most dangerous white person, Mr. Elon Musk. And I say he's dangerous for a very important reason. Rappers dying from non-gun-related tragedies, usually not the focus. Normally, rappers who get shot gets the attention. Fife, Sean Price, Helta Skelta, Prodigy. They left off Big Pun, Heavy D, Nate Dogg, Bushwick Bill, Guru from Gangstar. I didn't hear them mention those guys' names. I could have just missed it. But mental health of hip-hop artists who less than 5% of them own the art they create and produce. They have contracts that keep them in perpetual debt. They have to travel from city to city almost year-round to make a few thousand dollars to be able to afford a lifestyle they need to portray to be a rapper, to give up their appearance, they're rich. And also, they have to pay for protection, and they get extorted a lot, especially in their own neighborhoods where they came from. It's a very dangerous lifestyle. I remember when LL Cool J signed the biggest record deal in history. This was in the 90s. And he got 30 cent a CD. They called it 30 points. So 30 cent each CD a tape sold. And that was huge. That was big money. That was like bigger than white boys get. And that's how the record industry works. In 2019, now mind you, they've gone away from owning physical media like in the 90s where you bought CDs and tapes. Now you do downloads and streams. Spotify paid artists 0.0032% per stream. So 0.00, that's 1 cent right there. This is, you'll have to sell four streams to get 1 penny, you know, a little bit more than 1 penny. Apple does 0.0056, Google 0.0055, and Deezer does 0.0046. So these guys are, they're streaming, their music's all over the place, and they're getting less than a penny for that. And it's a sad lifestyle. I saw the footage of the looting in Chicago started by white people exclusively. The looting, someone sent me a link to an Instagram Live while they were filming the shooting. And I'm filming the rioting. All white people, all up in the Apple store, busting the windows out. And then a few hours, like an hour to an hour and a half later, black people come out jumping out of cars. They got the memo. They're going into empty stores, coming out with cash registers because they took everything. And these are the people that they focus on. This happened in northern Chicago. I've been to Chicago once. Black people don't live up there unless they're LGBT. A lot of the white people who were looting had on Black Lives Matter shirts, were not wearing masks, so they should be easy to pull out. Just today in Kalamazoo, Michigan, Proud Boys had a march. face off with counter protesters in Antifa. It got physical. I saw some brave brothers jumping into the crowd swinging. Not smart. Let the Proud Boys and Antifa fight out how they want to practice racism. Stand on the sideline and watch, you know. Melee today at Stone Mountain between Confederates and several black people jumping in, swinging poles at white people while Antifa's there. And I know it was seconds. Antifa because they had medic shirts on. Go ahead, Josh.
Oh, did you want your 30? I mean, you had 30 seconds left. Could have given the rest on Antifa.
Yeah, they had medic. Antifa has these people who have on a Red Force on the back of their shirt, and that's the medic. So if someone gets hurt, they jump in and help them, unlike black people, of course, but very efficient. I'm done, guys. I have more to say, but I'll come back later.
Much obliged. And somber, man. Like, that was from NPR when they were talking about the deceased hip-hop artists, and I think the black male that was being interviewed, he said he could have given a longer list, but he didn't. And that, you know, was just a portion of some of the folks who are no longer with us, most of them who died very, very young. Victims, I mean, talk about exploitation all the way through. System of racism, white supremacy. And then they'll have the audacity, they'll come back and say that this new generation of white people, they are so cool because they grew up listening to Jay-Z and Beyonce, so they love the Negro. Yes. The number 720-716-7300, decode 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. We have a little less than 30 minutes left in the broadcast. We should be here tomorrow, Global Sunday Talk on Racism, 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 noon Pacific. We're checking with listeners in different parts of the world. If you all have any questions you want to ask victims of racism, especially in an election year, see how the election is being covered around the world, feel free. I guess folks can feel free to share. If there are folks we missed, totally, definitely speak up. And then people think Kamala Harris, do we think she's classified as a black person or just as a non-white, non-black person? I thought non-white, non-black, definitely non-white. Didn't have any suspicion about, you know, that, but just I do not think she would be thought of, classified as a black person by a substantial number of individuals who classify themselves as white. She would just be, you know, saying Negro or something of that nature, but not a black person. Other folks' thoughts and or is this going to impact folks thinking the Biden-Harris ticket is going to be successful? What is it? The Biden and honorary Biden ticket, is that going to be successful? Folks can get their thoughts on that. People that have not shared at all, definitely do not wait till the last minute. Speak up. Folks who have other commentary, proceed.
May I be heard?
Caller in Florida. Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. Really quick on Miss Kamala Harris. I do think that she is in the non-white, non-black category, but I do think also that they try to strategically use the term the first this and the first African-American, and then they say the first Asian-American. You notice that these different terms keep being displayed to cause confusion, but I do think that they still remain the least confused. Speaking of that, it was a part of the segment where in the audio, the term, I think they were interviewing the person classified as Indian or Asian in Texas, and the person said, does that dilute that I think she has a parent that's Jamaican. I don't know if I'm saying this right, but that term diluted, that word tends to be used, I think, at times to contribute to anti-blackness. I'll just phrase it that way to be direct. I have heard that word used before, dilute. I don't know if anyone else has. The other segment about the they were talking about young people, and it made me think about when it comes to how the virus is being spread, you know, perpetuated or whatever, then they don't seem to indict white people, of course. And definitely this needs to be taken seriously. And they keep showing the footage of mass gatherings of white people. I even think that at one point, one of the schools in Georgia, maybe it was a white child, I think, put out footage or video or photographs of multiple students not wearing masks. And I think one area got like 59 cases in a school. So you still got that going on, a protest about children going back to school. There's a black male sheriff in Clay County. I believe he made the news briefly about saying that he wanted to deputize gun owners about these protests. So he may have been speaking in a way that I guess many white supremacists would favor. He seems to have he's being investigated. The governor had him step down, put out an order for him to step down. But we have an election coming up Tuesday here in Alachua, but I think it may be a cowbell situation. I'm not sure. He's married to a black female, but there's been that all over the news, and there has been protests up in Palatka about another monument. So, but I'm hearing that is a very dangerous area. My cousin even said that he was called a nigger. You know, going out to play basketball like a couple years ago when he was in high school, and you know, there was throwing stuff at the bus, pure terrorism, leaving there, I guess, on an away game. And that's all I have to share. Thanks for allowing me to speak. Thank you.
I do remember the black sheriff who was, I guess, talking about deputizing folks. We're not going to have any looting down here. Now he's being investigated. Sad. Very reminiscent of 2016, although I don't remember Sheriff Clark. That was one of Thomas in New York. It was one of his favorite folks way back when. But way back when it was Sheriff Clark in Wisconsin, had similar rhetoric and what have you. I don't remember him talking about deputizing folks to stop looters. Maybe he did, though. But he did get invited to the RNC and all that good stuff. Yeah, we'll see what happens down in Florida. So the report about diluting the fact, and I think the context of that question was they were talking to. So I have to see if I can say this person's name correctly. Sri Preston Kulkarni, I think is how you say it, Kulkarni. Kulkarni, I think is it. My apologies, I'm a victim of racism. But that's who was being interviewed on NPR. And so he was asked, do you think Kamala Harris, her having a so-called Jamaican parent, do you think that will dilute the so-called Asian support of Kamala Harris? That was the context of the dilution. I don't know. People can share if they hear a context where somebody comes to ask, I don't know, black people. Now, do you think President Obama having a white parent that will dilute Negro support of President? Like, I don't remember that specific word being used. Or
do they go to, you know, Jamaican people? Do you think Kamala Harris having an Asian parent, do you think that's going to dilute Jamaican support of her or how they think of her? Maybe they do. We can pay attention to see if they use that word. But, yeah, good catch. Words are important. Words are important. Let's see. Other folks, especially if we missed you totally, because we have about 15 minutes left in the broadcast. So if you have not shared at all and you think you have a comment, question, observation, you know of a generator that you would recommend that is healthy, is not going to kill us if we should have to use it for a week, if the power should go out unexpectedly, a generator, or if you have your counter-racist code together to share about emergency situations, the number again, 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Let's see. Folks that have not spoken at all, if you have commentary to share, lines should be open.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Did you get my email about the article?
Oh, I didn't. I'll pull it up right now. I didn't even check my email. I'll pull it up to the other article to make sure I got them both.
Okay, and I just wanted to make a quick commentary on Kamala Harris. For me, when I look at her, she looks like a black person. And it seems as if she's not, she's treated as a black female. I don't think she was a good pick. But at the same time, I don't think that so-called Americans choose who the president is. They have electoral college and stuff like that. So, yeah, for me, it's games. I don't know who they will select to be the president. To me, it's just a bunch of, I guess, metaphors. I can't use metaphors. but, yeah, I just think, you know, it's election season, and we're just going through this cyclical thing that we go through every 4 years when it comes to, you know, the American election. You know, I don't think I honestly don't think that the Democrats are trying to win the election. I mean, Joe Biden seems like he's senile. He's losing it. And, Kamala Harris, her background with the truancy and just her, you know, her background with the DA, as Thomas was talking about, you know, she just doesn't, they both don't, they're not a good pick. And Trump is Trump. And, yeah, that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Can I treated like black. Oh yes, yes, sir. I just wanted to ask real quick, ma'am. You said you think she's treated like a black woman,
like a black person, yeah, like a black female. Yeah, she seems like she. But at the same time, she also comes across like she herself don't view herself as black. But it seems like she's not, by the white society, she's not accepted as somebody who's not black. To me, that could be incorrect.
Interesting. Okay. Much obliged for the clarification. I think there might have been Henry in Chicago, the other male caller.
Yes. In regards to Kamala Harris, I know when she was running for president in the primaries, she had this thing where she was trying to prove to everybody how black she was, where, you know, she kept hot sauce in her purse and she listened to Tribe Called Quest and, you know, whatever. But I know she's not doing that now, and I'm pretty sure that's very strategical. And, you know, one of the things, too, is that they don't mention too much. I know they mention a lot about her mom, but mainstream media mentions very little about her father, and you know, who is Jamaican, as recently said. But also, too, one important thing about her is she's in a tragic relationship
with a white male who has ties to the state of Israel. So I think that's pretty interesting in regards to that. That's not talked about as much neither, about her tragic relationship with a white male. And I'm gonna say this because I feel like I'm in their predictions now, but if the metaphor oddball chance that Joe Biden wins the election, I got a feeling Kamala Harris is going to be she's going to be selected president down the line. But that's all I have right now in my life.
Wowee, Kamala Harris, future president. Could be. That'll be something to pay attention to, because there'll be a lot more attention, you know, on all of this, especially as we get to the debate. She'll be center stage for the debates. I guess that's late. Well, I don't know. With the Ronan, normally that would, I think, be like late September, maybe early October by the time it'd be her debate. So, yeah, but that'll be something to pay attention to. How often is her Jamaican father mentioned, and how often do they bring up the tragic rant? Yeah, lots to pay attention to in all this. Just see how it gets to November, a decision that has already been made, no doubt. Other folks, anybody that we missed, totally, definitely, make sure you get a hand up. Well, we have about 10 minutes left.
They gave us two selections, Gus. One was her. They narrowed it down to between her and Susan Rice. So you get Area 8 either way. In fact, this might have been more detrimental to Susan Rice, because she could end up in greater confinement, being that she's not that nominee now. We'll see what happens with what Barr, you know, does with the Pfizer debauchery they tried. But they're not going to do anything to Obama, I don't think, or Biden. But I wouldn't be surprised to see Susan Rice take the fall for that. Or other people as well. I want to say Portland, man. I mean, what more can be done? These white people in Portland have ripped this city to pieces, burnt down courthouses now. They are getting no punishment for this. I've never seen anything like this. There's no punishment. And it's not even played on the media here in New York at all. I got to go on alternative sites to actually see what they're doing. It's like they just don't want us to see it. And I think it's because they're white people. I personally think that something has to be done before the election. You can't continue to let this happen. Lastly, Gus, Akon, R&B/hip-hop star from Senegal. I know of him because he came from Senegal to Jersey City, engaged in some stolen car activity, ended up in greater confinement. And on his way home, he landed a record deal, lucrative deal. He had went to China and cut a deal. I believe it was Le Echo, but I could be wrong, to build a power grid in Africa. They gave him $1 billion worth of solar panels that they weren't using. And he was building this power grid over there, which was great. However, he gave an interview with a white supremacist, very refined racist named DJ Vlad. And he was asked, and I hate Vlad, the way he positions the question, because he really just wants to talk, but he's going to let you say a little something so he could give his opinion. And he asked, how did people in Senegal use slavery? Akon's response was, we got over it. And Akon said, the problem with Americans is they need to forget slavery and let go of their past. He didn't agree with us receiving reparations either. Now, mind you, this guy wouldn't be a star if it wasn't for a black American. But he did say that he feels like we should all move to Africa. And if we move to Africa, to Senegal, we wouldn't be dealing with white supremacy, because there is no white supremacy in Senegal. And mind you, Senegal only existed in 1960. You know, before that, it was called the French Sudan. So French people was ruling y'all. But either way, system white supremacy. I mean, my mind, thank you.
understand racism, white supremacy, what it is, how it works. Ellipsis, and just do the fade out right there. Victim, that's why you just try to read as many books as you can so that you can be more informed about all kinds of things. System of white supremacy, history of Senegal, colonialism as they call it on the continent, all kinds of things. Any other folks, comments they want to make sure they get in before we get ready to wrap up? Again, we'll be here tomorrow, Global Sunday Talk on Racism, 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 noon Pacific. Looking forward to checking in with our listeners from different parts of the globe. I'm trying to see if we can check in with Marquise Treve again as well. He's down in Brazil. It's been, man, what a year all the way around. Just to see what's happening down there as well, check in on the COVID situation as well. But Global Sunday Talk tomorrow, 3 Eastern, 12 noon Pacific. Other folks, commentary they want to make sure they get in. Check once more, see if everyone's satisfied. I heard Dr. Tommy Curry, one of his books, was mentioned. Lots to read. Check out, see if we have some other recommendations as we move along with the month here. I'll say for any of the folks that are looking to make adjustments and what have you to your diet, like literally, any of the foods that you enjoy, that you eat on a regular basis, unless it's just like steak, country ham, pork chop, unless it's something like that, might have a little bit of difficulty replicating. But pretty much anything else, you can still enjoy that as a plant-based version. They have plant-based they have plant-based corn dogs. So, you know, it's not too many things that you have to never have again. The goal, of course, is to get more plant-based whole foods where you're not eating a lot of crazy processed things, but just enjoying plants, vegetables, minimal processing. Get some raw fruits and veggies in there as well, some nuts, some beans, all that. It's not very difficult. It can be tasty. I cannot emphasize that enough. I'm not one of those folks that is just, we're going to have carrots right now. No, needs to taste great and still be nutritious. Carrot hot dogs, spectacular at the retreat. Smoothies, I think we might have thrown a carrot or two in the smoothie. I only have carrots in my smoothie unless it's, you know, like a watermelon contraption. I did have several really tasty watermelon smoothies this week. Also, if you're transitioning a blender, again, you do not have to have like a $500 blender. Doesn't have to be even a $300 blender. You can, you know, get a okay model and it will be great. It will be so helpful, especially in your transition. Everybody loves smoothies, at least most folks to my knowledge. That will be one easy way that you can do lots of fresh fruits and vegetables. That can be an easy meal replacement if you have a good smoothie. That can also be a food processor as well, but that can be so helpful in just allowing you to make lots of healthy snacks, treats, and even little accessories, sauces and things for your meal where you can make being plant-based really tasty, really enjoyable, and not feel like you're missing out on anything. Check in last time. If you have anything, you can get in 30 seconds. Matt will be here tomorrow afternoon, 3 Eastern, 12 noon Pacific. 30 seconds. Anybody have a last comment? Are folks good?
Yeah, have you heard?
Caller in Florida.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Gus. Really quick, I wanted to put emphasis on when they're saying the sexism and racism. The president came out saying that he's going to have the vote of suburban housewives. So how about that codification right there? And there are white women coming out already attacking Kamala Harris. So they definitely are practicing white supremacy. Wasting no time. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
FOMO years. That was
That was the neglected element in 2016. 52% of white women voters. Trump. I don't think that's going to change this time around just because they put honorary Biden on the team. So FOMO years. FOMO years. We will be here tomorrow. Well, man, we can ask some of our folks in different parts of the globe, you know, how the election is being reported and, you know, all the rest of it as we move into or get closer to November. Much obliged to folks for participating. Hope it was worthy of your Saturday evening. Hope you are eating healthy, nutritious, yummy things and taking great care of yourself. Self-care, central to counter-racism, central. You do not want to be on that list of folks in their 40s, late 30s, passing away, health-related ailments. Like, man, let's try to do as much as we can. The system of white supremacy, medical apartheid, and the coon man, that's what they have in store for us. Loaded up on all their medications and ooh, ow, ooh, can barely move. That's what they intend for us. Low quality of life in a short amount of years. Trying our best with each meal, each day, doing a little bit each day, trying to get a little bit better so that we can minimize that as best we can. That said, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. Preserve that brain computer. We are going to need high-level thinking to solve this problem. We do not need any toxins messing up the good brain computer that we have. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up every time we are in the vehicle. I still contend you hear what's happening in Chicago, Portland, lots of other areas. I would say let's try to hunker down. If you do have to go out, it's something essential, you know, necessary. Be very alert. If it looks like things might be getting hostile, someone is getting loud, violent, anything in that realm, this journey is done. We are all in exit mode. It is not really time to be taking risks and what have you. Assume, be thinking, this person could be armed. Matter of fact, many of these people could be armed, especially if it's white people. All of that said, if you're going to go out, you're sober, you're buckled, you're super alert to what's happening around you. You're not on the cell phone if you are driving. One, you need to be paying attention to what's going on. Number two, we're trying to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. Too many things happening. Try to keep control of as much as we can. We can chat and text it up once we get back to our residence. No name calling. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim.
Man, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.